Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is September 6th, 2015, and this is episode 91. Episode 91, Mario Mania. Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, we're kicking off GameBuoy's Mario Month, celebrating 30 years of Mario by taking a look at the core Mario game series. So buckle in and get ready for that. But first, we have our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits for you. Slaggy, do you want to get us started?
Yes, we heard over on the Capcom Unity, that there will be battle costume DLC pre-order bonuses for the upcoming Street Fighter V, and it'll depend on which franchise or storefront that you get it from. For pre-ordering on the PlayStation Store or getting the PC digital release. For pre-ordering on the PlayStation Store or getting the PC digital release, you'll get the battle costume Chun-Li. On Amazon.com, you'll get a battle costume M. Bison. At Best Buy, you'll get battle gear Cammy, which will probably be the favorite of Jamie Lee Curtis. And my personal favorite, which unfortunately is from GameStop, is Battle Gear Ryu, which you might have seen on the internet as Hot Ryu.
Or Dad Ryu.
Because he has a sexy beard, the thirst is real, and kind of makes me want to go to GameStop to pre-order it right now.
Yeah, you know, I gotta say, I'm a big proponent of Hot Ryu. I'm super into this. I don't like GameStop a whole lot, but I like Ryu with a beard.
Yeah, and dad beards.
I kind of need this in my life. So either way, if one of these costumes piques your interest, I would highly recommend you pre-order this game. You can find a link to the Capcom Unity post, which has pictures of all of these, over on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org. Yeah, and you know, as far as that Hot Ryu goes, consider me a little piqued.
We also have word here that Fantasy Life 2, the upcoming smartphone sequel to Level 5's hit 3DS title, has officially been delayed in Japan until 2016. There will be an online beta this winter, but, you know, development of the game is just going a little slower than they expected, so, you know, they had to push it back. And to that, you know, as always, I say, better a game delayed than be released awful.
Games are like a shit. Don't rush a good one.
That is disgusting.
And speaking of games that have not been rushed, Hajime Tabata-san, the director of Final Fantasy XV, announced at PAX Prime that in March 2016, Square Enix is going to be holding a major event which will include the reveal of the Final Fantasy XV release date. Finally!
And notable, Tabata-san did confirm that the game will be releasing in 2016.
It's also receiving the subtitle Final Fantasy XV Chinese Democracy.
That is not true, and it doesn't quite apply yet, Slaggy. You're being unkind.
What, but Chinese Democracy was a great record. I don't care what the haters say.
We also have word here that Bandai Namco's free-to-play Wii U project, which previously has been known as Project Treasure, has now officially been titled Lost Reavers.
Very cool.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. And apparently there will be a beta test announced, quote-unquote, in the near future for Japan.
Oh, nice.
We also have word here that Armika has been announced as a returning fighter for Street Fighter V.
Yes!
This, of course, is really awesome for those of you like myself who are big Street Fighter fans. Obviously, Armika was one of the standout characters from the Street Fighter Alpha subseries. She is like a cute girl version of almost like a Zangief playstyle. People typically think of her as like the Sakura to Zangief, the way that Sakura emulates Ryu. Armika is to Zangief.
Good life choices.
She still looks over the top with like her over-sexualized baby doll wrestler appearance. But, you know, I'm actually okay with it in this case because so much of wrestling costumes, like pro wrestling, which is what she's all about, is about over-the-top sexuality, over-the-top everything. And, you know, for me, I have seen some people get really controversial and discussing really heatedly whether or not Armika's costume is appropriate. To me, it is, because, you know, again, like I said, that's what girl wrestling is about, like, for pro wrestling. Like, you look at the WWE divas, they are not dressed that far off from this.
Right.
So, either way, super excited for Street Fighter V. I am definitely going to play Armika at some point. And something really cool about her is that her V skill, she starts monologuing and doing like a pro wrestler like trash talk. And the longer you let her monologue, like, the bigger damage buff she gets.
That's amazing.
To the point that if she finishes her entire monologue, which takes like 14 seconds or something, which in Street Fighter time, like 14 seconds of doing nothing is ridiculous, you can basically then one-hit kill the opponent.
Wow.
But again, who's ever going to get there? Like, especially in like tournament play, no one's ever going to get that.
Yeah.
So just a cool risk-reward concept. Really plays into the pro wrestling aspect of the character, and I'm super stoked.
Well,
about
I'll let
this
you
one.
Do it for the LOLs.
Woohoo! That'll be fun.
Firaxis has let us know that they will unfortunately be slightly delaying XCOM 2. Instead of a November release, we're now getting it on February 5th of next year. And they just said they want to have more depth, more replayability, and more investment in your soldiers. And so giving a little extra time to the development team will allow them to deliver on their promise.
That's awesome.
You know, again, something where I made a disgusting comment about not rushing a good one.
We also have word of two new Nintendo 3DS systems releasing this fall. The first one is the Hyrule Edition New Nintendo 3DS XL. It's going to be launching exclusively to GameStop on October 30th.
And basically another Triforce.
And it will be gold-colored and feature an intricate Hylian crest on the front. The other, and this is actually quite a big deal, is releasing on September 25th, and this is going to be the smaller version of the new 3DS, releasing for the first time in North America. It's going to be in a bundle with Animal Crossing Happy Home Designer. It will come with two cover faceplates based on Animal Crossing, as well as one of the Animal Crossing Amiibo cards. Something that's somewhat interesting about this, it's going to retail for $219.99. This means that the new Nintendo 3DS smaller version will be more expensive than the XL. But for those of you who have been begging Nintendo to give you a chance to buy this, this is your opportunity.
Yeah, damn it. Because one of them has Isabella on the front.
We also have word here coming from NetherRealm Studios that Mortal Kombat X is going to be getting four additional fighters in 2016. We don't yet know who these characters are, but, you know, keep looking forward to it. If you, like me, are into Mortal Kombat X, this is definitely something to look forward to.
Apparently, CD Projekt Red is going to be fixing the game's romances, or rather fleshing them out, in the upcoming patch for Witcher 3. That's because apparently there was some complaints about, like, oh, this love option wasn't as good as this love option. But, you know, I guess, you know, CD Projekt Red was listening to what the fans wanted. They delivered on it, so good on them. I mean, I'm just a little salty that Geralt can't romance a sexy man. But, you know, whatevs.
We also have word that Mega Dimension Neptunia 7, this is, of course, the first Neptunia game for PlayStation 4, will be releasing in North America in early 2016. As well as that, Activision has announced that they are re-releasing their Deadpool game, this time for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. Port is being handled by a bunch of people who used to work at High Moon Studios, which, you know, made the game, and it'll be releasing on November 17th for $49.99. Deus Ex Mankind Divided has had its release date announced. That's going to be February 23rd. And last, but certainly not least, Uncharted 4 will be releasing on March 18th for PlayStation 4. This is probably the last time you hear us talk about Uncharted 4, so have fun with that. Slaggy, unless you have anything else, I think it's time for some news.
He looks so stubbly and sexy. Forget Dad Ryu. Nathan Drake all the way.
News. 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 Oh my god. News.
First up, we have a big announcement here. At PAX Prime 2015, Nintendo officially revealed the Shovel Knight amiibo.
Yeah!
This is going to be the first quote-unquote indie game amiibo, as well as the first amiibo that's actually being made not by Nintendo themselves. It's being handled by Yacht Club Games, with Nintendo just sort of licensing out the amiibo tech to them. So, it, you know, very interesting. More interesting is that this amiibo is actually, in the Wii U version of the game, going to unlock a cooperative multiplayer mode.
Yes!
This is, of course, a big deal because there is not a co-op multiplayer mode in any of the other versions of Shovel Knight to date. The 3DS version will also have Shovel Knight amiibo compatibility, of course. And in that version, it will unlock new appearances, abilities, and relics when you scan the amiibo. So, definitely looks like they're going to be adding a lot to the game. And, you know, obviously Shovel Knight was one of our favorite games here last year, so...
Yeah, I love Shovel Knight so much.
Yeah, me too. I would definitely keep my eyes open for this.
Sony Computer Entertainment Japan Asia is going to be hosting their annual SCEJA press conference. That'll be taking place on September 15th this year, and it'll be at 1600 hours Japanese Standard Time. So for those of you in the United States like us, that is 12 o'clock Pacific Time, midnight, 3 a.m., Eastern Time. And if you are over in Britain, I know there's a couple of you over there, so that'll be at 7 o'clock in the morning, presumably, Greenwich Mean Time.
Excellent.
Or would that be in the evening? I don't know how to do British times correctly.
I'll be honest with you, I'm not entirely sure myself.
How do I geography? No, seriously, geography was like my worst subject in school.
Oh, man, I feel for you there. We also have word here that several well-loved cave shoot-em-ups are going to be getting Steam releases this winter. This is going to be coming via Dejica, whom we've talked about here a little bit on the show before. They're going to be publishing such games as Dodonpachi, Akai Katana, Death Smiles, and more. So this is something to look forward to, and apparently they will start rolling out this winter.
Might be time for a shmup buoy.
It very well might be. We also have word here from Square Enix that they are ending service of their free-to-play RPG Final Fantasy Agito on November 30th. But they will be shifting towards a new, quote-unquote, reborn development. You know, obviously, Agito has not released yet in North America, though they have said that they are going to be bringing it over. One has to assume at this point we won't be getting this version of the game, but hopefully we will be getting whatever Agito Reborn comes up.
I agree, especially if it has anything to do with Final Fantasy XIV and Realm Reborn.
We also have word that Hatsune Miku is getting a new game on Vita and PlayStation 4 in Japan. This is going to be Hatsune Miku Project Diva X, and it's going to be releasing on Vita in March. And then later in the year on PlayStation 4, specifically in the fall. This game is going to have an all-new quest mode, which is going to be very new for this series. And the concept is going to be like focused on like live performance and production. So please look forward to it.
We have some information about Double Fine's next game. It's called Headlander, and it stars you as a disembodied head that lands on various bodies to take them over, which gives you new abilities. So it's basically like a... disembodied head Metroidvania.
That is super exciting, and it kind of reminds me of an old Nintendo game called Geist, which had you playing as a ghost that could possess other characters in the game world and gain whatever abilities they had while you were possessing them.
Wow, that sounds super spoopy.
It was actually like a first-person shooter game. It was made by Nintendo, dev'd specifically by N Studio, I think.
Wow, you know, maybe we'll need to talk about some spoopy Nintendo games.
Possibly. Anyway, it was a cool game. I loved, like, constantly, like, changing your capabilities based on changing bodies. And it sounds like we're going to be getting that in a Metroidvania setting here. So I'm super excited. This game is going to be releasing in 2016, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it more here on the show.
Yeah, Double Fine is good times.
Apparently, Hollywood is making a Mega Man movie.
Oh, boy.
More specifically, apparently 20th Century Fox and Chernin Entertainment have licensed Mega Man, are optioned Mega Man, and they're working on making a movie. So
Chernin just sounds like the name of like some random new Pokemon.
Chernin.
Yeah, I you know, I'm always super skeptical when like these movie games are announced, but whatever. Yeah. I guess we'll
Although
see.
The apparently the Chernin chairman rather the CEO is the owner of Crunchyroll, Peter Chernin. So, you know, Crunchyroll's decent, so.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Crunchy, so we'll see how that one plays out.
Chernin.
Choo-choo.
We also have word here from NCSoft and Carbine Studios that WildStar is going to be relaunched on September 29th as WildStar Reloaded. The big change here, I know, because they're obviously going to be doing, you know, a whole new character creation experience, changing all the dungeons, itemizations, and skills. They're making a ton of changes, but the big one, the major deal here for most of us, is that this reboot is going to be free to play. So, you know, I at one point did play WildStar. I will definitely come back after this relaunch.
Yeah, it looks really cool. I didn't realize that you can basically be a Draenei with a mohawk.
Excuse me? A robot Draenei. A robot Draenei.
And don't forget the robot.
We also have word here that Ace Attorney 6 has been announced in Japan for release for 3DS. We don't yet know a whole lot about the game itself, but it will be showcased in Capcom's booth at this year's Tokyo Game Show, which at this point is just a few weeks away, so please look forward to that.
And it looks like that's Phoenix Wright's silhouette, right?
It certainly does.
So those of you who can't stand Apollo Justice, I guess you don't have to worry.
And Capcom has already confirmed that Ace Attorney 6 will be coming to the West. They will have more information on the Western release for us soon. In indie fighting game news, My Little Pony Friendship is Magic Doujin Soft fighting game, Fighting is Magic, is being released finally. You may recall that Hasbro filed a cease and desist against the game back in 2013. I think we may have reported on this. Basically, Main Six, the person who has been making the game for the last several years now, has changed all of the characters to not be My Little Pony related. The game is now going to be called Them's Fightin' Herds and is scheduled to release on September 21st. So please look forward to it. Or I should say the crowdfunding to get the game finished is going to launch on September 21st, but as I understand, there will be a downloadable product of some kind, maybe a demo or something, to go along with that. So either way, it sounds like the game's finally on track, and you know, the fighting game community actually had a really positive response to this back when it was a My Little Pony doujin.
Yeah.
So that's a big part of why, despite not being interested in fighting horsies, I am excited about this game.
Yeah.
And last, but certainly not least, in a bit of a weird news, we have word here that the Mad Max movies are releasing as downloadable on Steam. So, you know, it's we've already seen short films, we've already seen documentaries, we've seen movies about video games on Steam. This is the first time we're seeing just straight up, like, AAA Hollywood productions release on Steam. It's interesting, of course, to think, you know, that next year, we may very well be looking at a Steam that is almost like a one-size-fits-all store for all your entertainment needs.
Except not everything is most definitely not on your radar. Something definitely should be. I just dropped the ball on that one.
What on earth do you even mean?
Oh, no, just that these are, like, the first time that they've had, like, big budget films.
Well, so that was literally what I just meant. This was the first time they were getting, like, AAA Hollywood productions. And so it's interesting to think, like, if this is a new direction for them, if they're really going to be, like, an iTunes competitor almost. You know, Steam started off as Valve's way to sell Half-Life directly to you. And now it's like, are they the new iTunes? Maybe. Interesting times.
Indeed.
All right, well, unfortunately, we are moving on to a little bit of
Doom and Gloom.
Base Discs has been totally canceled, by which I mean Mortal Kombat X for 360 and PS3 has officially been canceled.
Space Swords! Totally canceled.
You know, the last-gen versions were delayed time and time again, and finally they were just like, no, we're not gonna finish them.
And, you know, I actually have to shout out to Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment's official response, or statement, I should say. After months of development, Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment has come to the regrettable conclusion that we cannot release Mortal Kombat X for PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. Please know that our teams worked diligently to meet the quality standards set by the current-gen versions of the game. We were not able to get the PS3 and Xbox 360 versions to the quality expected of a Mortal Kombat game, and are very sorry for not being able to deliver the products as originally planned. And to me, I gotta say, I am super happy they gave us a straightforward answer here. I think it's really cool of them to be like, you know, this game is crap, and we don't want to release it. It sucks for the people who are waiting. But again, I would much rather them cancel a game release like this than release something substandard that people end up regretting having spent money on.
Yeah. Bandai Namco has announced that Soul Calibur Lost Swords, which is the free-to-play single-player online PS3 game, is going to be ending service on November 30th. There will be a farewell event in sales before the ending of the game.
You know, this sucks. I know a lot of people were into Lost Swords. Probably not as many as Namco Bandai was hoping for, but still, this sucks, and hopefully the game is going to get resurrected on the current-gen consoles.
Yeah.
We also have some news here that is...
controversial.
Oh my god.
So, there was apparently going to be an unofficial Pokemon PAX kickoff party at PAX Prime last weekend, but because they were charging for tickets, they used Pokemon and, like, the promotional material, the Pokemon Company sued.
Yeah. And, you know, this is controversial because, you know, a lot of people are like, you know, the Pokemon Company is damaging their brand by going after the fandom. And, you know, they shouldn't be doing this. They should be glad that people have their, all of this passion for the product. But for me, it's like, dude, like, you guys are charging for entry to this Pokemon event. Like, you're heavily using, like, Nintendo and Pokemon art, like, this
is honestly not very well, might I add.
Yeah, and it looks super amateur hour. It's just, I have to say, like, honestly, I'm sorry, I'm kind of with Pokemon on this one. I feel bad, but it's just, it does not look good to me. I feel like it's appropriate for this to be getting shut down.
I mean, there's no reason that they couldn't have done, like, Monster Mania.
Well, dude, here's the thing. Like, it's cool to have themed events. It's cool to you know, get people out there at cons, get people into, you know, they have... And they spell tournament wrong in their promotional stuff for this, but it's like, dude, all kinds of Smash Bros. Tournaments have covers to get in and pay for the cash payout for the prizes and stuff. Just do that for your monetization. That alone would.
But then the flyer also says no cover all night.
Even though they were charging for entry. So, I mean, you know, the thing is, the complaint by the Pokemon Company really was specifically about two things. And the first is that they were using the character images on their promo material, like straight up copy-pasted art materials of Pokemon. And the second was that they were charging for tickets. These were so easy to work around. People throw theme parties all the time. The theme party part is cool, but don't use official promo materials, even if they look hella ugly, that sets the expectation that this is an official Nintendo event, which it's obviously not. And then second, you know, don't charge a cover or an entry fee for these things. You can monetize them in other ways, but not just entry. Like, that is very specifically been verboten for so many of these video game themed events. And it's crazy to me that so many people think that Pokemon Company / Nintendo are the bad guys here. They're protecting their product. They're protecting the way that, you know, the fans sort of see the product. They don't want people to mistake this for being an official event. I cannot fault them for this.
Yeah.
We also have word that Steam is getting an uncensored sex game.
Yes.
This one is Kindred Spirits on the Roof. It is a game about two ghosts who are eternally bound to a school, and the only way they can rest in peace is if they ghostly bone each other. Obviously, Steam has gotten a number of erotic games over the last few years. What makes this one different, I think, might be that the two ghosts who fall in love, I'm pretty sure, are both girls. So, you know,
sexy ghosties.
It would seem to me that lesbian sex scenes are probably more acceptable on Steam than heterosexual sex scenes or sex scenes that involve penis. I'm not surprised by this, and I might play this game. I'm wondering how explicit the sex scenes are, because I'm seeing a lot of people making this just about, like, oh, this is just because of male gaze. Lesbians are okay, but other combinations aren't. But I'm wondering if, like, maybe all you see is, like, side boob or something. Like, maybe maybe the reason it's not censored is that there wasn't anything to censor. Maybe by H-game standards, maybe it's pretty tame. Which would not surprise me, given that it has, like, a romance plotline. I'm seeing a lot of people get very upset about this game being allowed to release uncensored when we've seen so many games get censored. But to me, I think that it's sort of a misnomer. Like, okay, the game isn't being censored, but maybe that's just because it didn't have content that Steam needed to
have
censor.
To see.
So time will tell on that one, but definitely something I've seen people talking about this week.
I just had to shout out.
Probably
really
speaks to the kinds of people I follow on the internet.
Right.
I'm sorry, continue.
Oh, no, just one of the commenters on this Kotaku article said, "Ghost can't do it." And then the author of the article, Patricia Hernandez, said, "How do you know? You tried fucking a ghost before? Maybe you were doing it wrong." And I'm like, ah!
That is amazing.
I wonder if Kesha will play this.
One of the other big controversial stories this week is that apparently one of the big story scenes in Metal Gear Solid 5 was cut from the game due to how expensive it would have been to produce it.
Oh my god, is it about the dog?
It is not. You know, we all know that Kojima-san was under a lot of pressure from Konami to cut the dollars being spent, you know, toward the end. And apparently several of the game's big storylines were meant to resolve in one scene altogether because all of these mysteries tie up together. And basically, they didn't have the money to actually do the scene. So there's a version of it in the collector's edition of Metal Gear Solid 5 that basically shows a non-finished version of the cutscene that does tie up several storylines that a lot of gamers were very concerned, like, hey, what happened to this character and this character and this giant robot? And these things end up answering in what was supposed to be Mission 51, which, again, was unfortunately not actually made. The game,
oh, wow.
The game ends at Mission 46. So
Poochie died on the way back to his home planet.
Yeah, it's pretty wild stuff. A lot of people are saying that, you know, hopefully there will be some DLC to finish this.
Yeah, this kind of reeks of Mass Effect 3 almost.
Well, right? Except in this case, like, literally, like, several characters through this cutscene get moved from the positions they were in at the end of Metal Gear Solid 5 to where they're supposed to be in the timeline before the next game happens. So people know, like, straight up, like, this doesn't make sense. Like, how did this character get out of this situation?
Oh, yeah, because 5 takes place in the past.
Exactly. And it's apparently this Mission 51, which has footage on the Collector's Edition bonus disc, very explicitly answers those questions. So this is just really scummy to me on Konami's part. Increasingly, it feels like they rushed the game out even before Kojima-san was finished with it, and just very, very disappointing. Very disappointing. And last but certainly not least, the last controversy that we have seen this week and want to talk about relates to the pre-order bonuses of Deus Ex Mankind Divided. This is doing something similar to what we've seen from Capcom, I believe, did something similar on the Resident Evil Steam release pre-order, where the more people pre-ordered the game, everyone would get more pre-order bonuses.
Right.
That's happening here with Deus Ex, except the bonuses are actually quite a bit bigger. Like, the tier one bonus lets you choose like three different packs of loadouts for the game itself. Like, you'll get, you know, more weaponry to play in the game when it comes out. Tier two was a soundtrack and digital art book. Tier three gives you an extra in-game mission. Tier four is for a digital comic book and novella. And tier five is an early release of the game, 4 days before the actual retail launch.
So it's Deus Ex pre-order bonus divided.
Ah, well done. You know, obviously their goal here, Square Enix's goal, is that they want people to pre-order the game and then encourage and pressure their friends to pre-order it so that you can get all of, like, the bonus tier stuff. The problem, of course, is, like, basically they're gating content in, and obviously they're going to charge for all of this stuff if these pre-orders don't get met, and this is making a lot of people very uncomfortable. Like, basically we're being asked to pre-order a game unsure of what the contents of the game are even going to be at release. So definitely tricky territory to maneuver here. Lots of people have a lot of feelings about it, and it's something that I think we'll probably be revisiting as we get closer to the release of the game.
Oh yeah, you know, just the whole fuckery with pre-orders. I've seen a lot of particularly on Kotaku about, like, don't pre-order games. It's showing companies that it's okay to do shit like this.
Yeah, and you know, it's hard to argue that in some ways. Like, I like pre-ordering games because I like knowing I'm going to get a game when it comes out. But when it comes to, like, creepy, gross stuff like this, I think that's actually really, like, diminishing to the product. Like, I just think it's offensive. I think it's dirty, and I think it really, it's just gross. I don't like it at all. So that's definitely something to be mindful of moving forward.
Indeed.
All right. Well, with all of that having been said, I think it's time for us to start our discussion on this series of games that is well loved and hugely influential. Slaggy.
It's not really that big of a deal. Come on.
So, the first game we're going to talk about here, and the very reason for this show on so many levels, because obviously Mario is as fundamental as it gets.
Ooh, Peach, the castle is open. Welcome, Lady Toads and Toads, to Mario is Fundamental.
So, you know, Super Mario Brothers is obviously responsible in such a big way for, you know, our passion for this hobby itself, for where gaming has gone, for where gaming has been. And,
entire North American video game industry basically was saved by this game series.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's just, when we first talked about even doing a Mario Brothers episode, to some degree, I was a little bit staunch. Like, I don't know, Slaggy. Staunch? Like, I don't really think that Mario is very left of center. But, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I realized Slaggy was right. We have to talk about Mario. I talked about this a little bit when we talked about Mario Kart. Like, it just, to some degree, you gotta pay it where it's due. And in
this
case,
you gotta do the Mario.
It is due to Mario. We owe Mario so much. We owe Nintendo so much for making these games. And, when this first Super Mario Brothers game was released, this was Japan, got it September 13th, 1985. So that's obviously 30 years ago, like a week. We got it, toward the end of the year in North America in 85 as well. And then Europe and Australia did not get it until 1987. But it changed the world, Mario did. Like, it changed our expectations of what platform games are and what they can be. It's hard to think of a more instrumental and influential game experience than Super Mario Brothers. You have the amazing 6-song score that Koji Kondo did. We just have all of the amazing level design that Miyamoto-san and his team put together for these games. It's a phenomenal game. It's incredible. And I just wanted to give this little preamble before I let Slaggy talk about the game, just to say, Super Mario Brothers, for so many of us gamers of our age, Super Mario Brothers is where it began for many of us.
I mean, that was my first gaming experience, for sure.
So, Slaggy, why don't you talk a little bit about Super Mario Brothers?
Well, Super Mario Brothers is a platforming game where you control Mario or his brother Luigi through the Mushroom Kingdom, defeating enemies, getting coins from blocks, and doing all sorts of platformy things, going through pipes, going through dungeons and water worlds and mushroomy platforms, and trying to defeat Bowser and rescue the princess, which, you know, at this point we say, oh, it's the damsel in distress trope, but I mean, you know, back then it was really, you know, this, even without dialogue and, you know, branching story arcs or whatever, you know, it still told a story, and, you know, you were immersed right there in the world. And I mean, one of the things that I think really makes this game so, you know, influential, and the reason it has such a big appeal, is like when you think about World 1-1, which, I mean, I'm pretty sure anyone who's listening to the show knows what World 1-1 looks like, the very first world, you know, you zone in from the title screen. And I mean, people, I think, talk about this a lot, but it needs to be said, just the way that first screen communicates to you what you need to do as a player. You know, a lot of players for the very first time might run right into the Goomba and then be like, oh, Goomba bad. And the first mushroom that you get is not only very hard to avoid getting, because, you know, you're like, oh, I can jump, I'm going to jump, and I'm going to hit this block because it's so low on the, you know, from where the ground is. And then the mushroom itself is hard to avoid, which teaches you can be Super Mario and transform. So, you know, just the fact that very first screen is designed to teach you fundamentals of the game is, like, huge. And I think that really is something that we've seen in Nintendo design philosophy to this day. And, you know, especially now that we'll be talking at the end about Mario Maker, how it's really coming full circle. But, it's just really influential in that way that, you know, it taught you how to play the game. And it, you know, then as you progress, you know, you get the star, the fire flower, and you see the other types of power-ups you get. The question blocks have a question mark, and they're shiny because they, want you to be hitting them. You know, it's designed to be alluring. So, I mean, just all of these elements in the design that, make it super accessible, but also, like, there's still so many secrets to discover, too. You know, like, hidden one-ups, and, the pipes have, like, underground things, the warp zones, that, to us these days, we think, oh, yeah, everyone knows about the warp zones, but, I mean, just the fact that all of these were hidden in this game, I mean, I think it's just as astonishing that something on this scope, when you think about platformers in the past, I mean, I think probably Pitfall is the only one I can really think of before Super Mario Brothers that really, comes close to being this sort of level. Maybe Pac-Land was kind of a pioneering platformer as well, but
I wouldn't say all that.
I mean, just to show you where platforming was before Super Mario, and just also the different environments. There was typically they followed, and I mean, I'm probably not super accurate here, but typically there's a above ground one, an overworld, then there's a underground dungeon, and then there's typically either a water world or like a mushroom platformy, tree platformy thing with like the little ladder thingies, and then the Bowser dungeon. So just the fact that there was such a variety of different environments, and particularly like the water ones, you had to navigate that as swimming. It's very easy to think of this game as simple, but there's really so much going on in it for the game, and just knowing that what we know now about how much it evolved and grew. I mean, it's just really astonishing to think how everything in this game came together.
Well, and it's funny because you say, that we think of it as simple, and certainly in 2015 we do. But I would also argue that a big part of it is when you really stop and think about it, the first Super Mario Brothers game is not super easy. We think of it as a simple game, but when you think of the Nintendo hard meme, people don't think of Super Mario Brothers in that category, even though in a lot of ways it is just as demanding of the player in terms of skill and cognition of what's going on around you and being able to, in real time, react to obstacles. The difference
can still be a bitch.
The difference is, as you described, Slaggy, this game is designed so intuitively. It is a masterwork of design that really teaches the player how to play it as you're going through, that you never think of the game as unfair. You never think, oh, this game sucks, it's the game's fault that I failed. No, it's always on the player, because the game always communicates to the player what's going on, what's expected. The only time that the game veers from that is really in that 8-4 castle, where there's some like light puzzle solving elements.
Right.
You have to go in the right order of pipes and pathways, but even that is sort of communicated to the player in, was it the World 6 castle that has a similar mechanic?
I think so. And then there's the World 7 castle, which has like the if you don't do the right pathways.
And so exactly. So even then, the game is teaching you how to play it. It's giving you a warm-up before giving you the real thing. It's using all of these amazing visual cues to teach you how to jump, how to collect power-ups. It is a masterwork of game design. And in so many ways, Super Mario Brothers, to me, was like the beginning of modern game design. You look at what came before the first Super Mario Brothers game, and things were very esoteric, very arbitrary, very little reason or rhyme to like what you're expected to accomplish as a player.
Right.
Super Mario Brothers, in so many ways, was really the starting point of showing a player how to play a game, leading them by their hand while still also challenging them. And it's just, to me, it's you couldn't possibly say enough about the first Super Mario Brothers game. And
yeah,
it's funny because this game was actually, internally, when they were designing it, they sort of were on like a really tight schedule because they had wanted the game available like practically the same year that they started developing it. They were like, we want this out before the holiday shopping season.
Yeah, and because the Famicom Disk System was about to come out.
Well, yeah, exactly. So they were kind of looking at this as like the last big Famicom game. And it's so funny because when you think about it, in so many ways, it really gave the Famicom and the NES, like, this was really the start of where it became a phenomenon. This was the start of where it became, the must-have device.
Right.
Prior to Mario Brothers, in North America, the big seller of the NES was what, like, Gyromite and Duck Hunt?
Pretty much.
And after Mario Brothers, it was like, no, we're going to start packing in Mario Brothers. Like, even if it's on a cart along with Duck Hunt, we're packing in Mario Brothers. So, just an absolute, absolute phenomenon. Looking at it now, there's so much you could say that I literally don't even know where to begin. It's to me, in so many ways, the epitome of a perfect game.
Right. You know, something that I always found really interesting is that it was originally going to have, like, shooting mechanics. And, like, I can't even imagine, like, a world where Mario was not the Mario that we got, you know?
Well, I mean, to me, if you really want to experience that, just play Super Mario World, which does have those shooting
Do you mean
sequences.
Super Mario Land?
I'm sorry, Super Mario Land.
Right,
yes,
which I was just thinking of.
And we'll talk about Super Mario Land in a few minutes. But, Saggy, do you have anything else you'd really like to say about Super Mario Brothers? Because I realize we have, like, 12 games to talk about here, so...
You know, like you were saying, there's so much that could be said. But really quickly, I just wanted to touch on the physics. You know, typically we don't think of gaming physics in, like, 8-bit era being super, like, advanced or anything. But if you've... consider the way that the movement of Mario just feels so fluid, even playing it today. You know, the jumps feel really responsive. We have to keep in mind historically that that wasn't always the case, that in earlier games, you know, jumping felt very, like, you know, slow, or, you know, just didn't feel, like, very visceral. Like, and that's something that I always felt that really was pioneered by Super Mario Brothers, is that, you know, the controls just, they felt tight. And I mean, you know, maybe they were not, you know, the most refined physics ever in gaming. But, you know, I mean, I just, to this day, you know, you play it, it feels good to play. And that's not always true, even with modern games, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just definitely establishing that Nintendo seal of quality very, very early on.
And, you know, I want to actually build on that statement a little bit that you were making about the physics and mechanics. Jeremy Parrish once, and this would have probably been a good 10, 15 years ago now, whenever Mario Sunshine came out, he had remarked, you know, that the Mario games are fundamentally about running and jumping.
Yeah.
And the reason why...
Jumpman.
The reason why the games work so well, why they're so cohesive, is because on a fundamental level, they nailed that mechanic from the get-go, and every game after that has been minorly tweaking those properties and augmenting those abilities where appropriate. So much so that you know, you have entire games just based around the concept of changing Mario's jumping mechanic, Super Mario Sunshine in particular, which is a game about giving Mario the leverage to change the height of his jump or change the distance that he can jump through the water hovering. And it's just, to me, so interesting to think that this well-loved game series, this fundamental game series, is really at its core about run and jump, just expertly executed.
I agree. And, you know, it's just really interesting to think about things that were just decided kind of like, oh, that would be fun, like the power-up mushroom, which they included because of, like, you know, like, eat me, drink me from Alice and that sort of thing. And, you know, just the idea of the mushroom that makes you grow. But that power-up mechanic becoming huge. I mean, even to this day, it's like, oh, what new costumes is Mario going to have? Meow, meow, Mario, Squirrel Mario, etc., you know? So just thinking about how things that maybe they weren't thinking, like, too much about, like, oh, the future of, you know, this franchise or whatever, really made a huge impact.
And speaking of the future of the franchise, in 1986, the first Mario sequel released in Japan.
Yep, Super Mario 2. Mario Brothers 2.
This released on June 3rd, 1986, on the NES in Japan and nowhere else.
On the Famicom.
Okay, it was system. Actually on the Famicom disk system, but it's the NES in terms of platform. I mean, really.
Yes, I know. I'm being one of those people.
So one of the big differences here that most people notice is that there's no two-player option in the game, but you can be Mario or Luigi.
Mario game, Luigi game.
The difference, though, is that the two characters actually play differently. In Mario Brothers 1, Super Mario Brothers 1, I should say, you know, there was very specifically, like, no difference between playing as Mario and Luigi. Just, if you're playing two-player, one person is Mario, one is Luigi. They're the exact same characters in terms of play, but they're colored differently. In Mario Brothers 2, and I should say Super Mario Brothers 2, because we are talking about Super Mario Brothers here, not the original single screen arcade game Mario Brothers. Luigi was actually controlled quite differently from Mario. He had way less ground friction, so he controlled quote unquote a little sloppier, but he had a higher jump height, which in Super Mario Brothers 2 was actually very useful. Super Mario Brothers 2 was very specifically designed to be almost like Super Mario Brothers for pro players.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think they even had a ad campaign calling it like Mario for super players or something.
Yeah, I recall that as well.
And, you know, so very specifically, Miyamoto-san and his team went and basically made, like, a tricksy version of Super Mario Brothers. So there's, like, negative mushroom power-ups, like, bad level warps that will actually send you back to earlier stages of the game. Like, mid-air wind gusts where the game would actively mess with the physics of the game to, like, make jumps harder on you. You know, there were, like, totally hidden bonus worlds that were super not intuitive. And, you know, the game actually, even in Japan, got a lot of flack for being so hard. And, in fact, the game was so hard that Nintendo of America actually declined to release this game in North America, which is why Super Mario Bros. 2, as we know it, and which we will be talking about in just a moment, is actually like a retrofitted version of a completely different game. Obviously, we're talking about Doki Doki Panic.
Doki Doki Panic.
But we'll get there.
What?
It's such a strange game. I like Super Mario Brothers 2, or as, you know, I know it, Super Mario Brothers Lost Levels, is probably true for, you know, quite a few of us. The game actually, like, gets way harder as it goes on too, and it's basically hard from the beginning, so that's really something. Lost Levels, as we think of it, is just very specifically made to teach you to be pro. It's if you're the kind of player who likes speedrunning and that sort of stuff, and you've never played Lost Levels, I would recommend that you prioritize it. It's definitely an experience. So, like, what are your experiences with Lost Levels, and what do you have to say about it?
Lost Levels is hard as fuck. Definitely, you know, I'm not the most technically skilled player, so I definitely, you know, find it very frustrating, but I admire it for what it is. And something that I just, you know, always think about is that at the time we didn't have internet. All we really had were gaming magazines, Nintendo Power, etc. So for, I think, a lot of us out there, we had no idea that Super Mario Brothers 2, as we knew it, was not the original Super Mario Brothers 2. I mean, probably a lot of us weren't even thinking, like, oh, Mario came from Japan, you know? Like, a lot of kids probably didn't even think about that. But, you know, then discovering upon the release of Super Mario All-Stars that this existed was like, what? And then being like, oh. But yeah, I mean, definitely the wind is definitely very frustrating. And, you know, I have to say, we'll talk about Super Mario Brothers 2 USA in a minute, but I really think that, as much as I respect what this game was trying to do, I think really Nintendo of America probably did make a decision that really saved the franchise in the end. Because I can't imagine what the response would have been if they had gone through and released this. I really don't know if the game would have taken off and the series would have taken off, you know, as it has.
Yeah, unfortunately, I absolutely agree with you. I like Lost Levels. I've really come around on it. But I have to admit, I don't think Super Mario Brothers would have become the phenomenon it is if this had been released in North America. Like, truly, I think Nintendo of America was right.
Yeah, you know, as we'll kind of talk about with Super Mario Brothers 2, Super Mario USA, whatever you want to call it, just the fact that it looked outdated
Doki
at that point. Doki Doki Panic, that it looked outdated at that point.
Well, and you know, there was internally at Nintendo of America, there was also a real big push not to iterate, basically. Like, you know, Zelda 2 is a great example. Like, they really wanted games to be very different so that purchasers, consumers, weren't, you know, feeling like they were buying the same game over and over. So
something that the modern industry could maybe think about.
All right. Once again, Nintendo was 20, 30 years ahead of its time. But I want to talk about that now. I want to talk about Doki Doki Panic or Super Mario Brothers USA or Super Mario Brothers 2. This one released in North America for the NES on September 9th, 1988. Released in the EU on April 28th. 1989. In Australia, May 4th, 1989. And in Japan, this, of course, as the Super Mario USA version, on September 14th, 1992. The original Yume Koujo Doki Doki Panic released on the Super Famicom, or I'm sorry, the Famicom Disk System in Japan on July 10th, 1987. Now, Yume Koujo Doki Doki Panic is a very different game from the Super Mario series. So it's really funny that in a lot of ways, the sort of design of that game has so much influenced the Super right. Mario Brothers series. And this is something that Slaggy and I actually talk about a lot.
Yeah, there's a great YouTube that I watched that just as supplemental material we'll link to you over on GameBuoy.org.
So there was GameBuoy.org. There was, four characters in Doki Doki Panic, Imagine, Mama, Lina, and Papa.
Yep.
And, they had sort of the different abilities that we think of now as associated to Super Mario Brothers.
Right.
This was the first time that Mario was distinctly shorter than Luigi.
Uh-huh.
This was the first time Princess Peach gained her ability to float. This was the first time Luigi gained his little kickin' feets in the sky.
Right, and it's just
Toad
so funny.
Toad became, like, the little squat, like, fast pickup guy.
Right.
It's funny, you were saying?
No, just that Luigi also was the high jumper in this, that that is something that, I don't think they probably, I don't know if they...
Well, I've always assumed that was intentional based on what they had done in Mario Brothers 2, that's uh-huh. why they thought he fit here, as the high jumper.
Are we going to talk a little about the history of Doki Doki Panic itself?
Well, why don't you get us started on that?
Well, Doki Doki Panic was developed by a lot of the same people as worked on the original Super Mario Brothers game, including a... what is now iconic, in my opinion, soundtrack by Koji Kondo-san. It was actually made for the Yume Koujo 87 event from Fuji Television. Fuji TV had a very strong relationship with Nintendo, to the point where there was even a reskin of the original Super Mario Brothers that was replaced with, some of the Fuji TV mascots for... an earlier festival they had done. And so this game, was based around the Yume Koujo 87 mascots, who were Imagine, Lina, Mama, and Papa. And so, that's why we kind of have, some of a Arabian almost setting for some of the levels. And, so when this game was sent over, because what happened is that, I can't remember the gentleman's name who was mentioned in this video I was watching, but he would test out these games and then kind of share them with Nintendo of America, what he thought and if they'd be good to bring over. And so at the time they were thinking about, we need a sequel to Super Mario Brothers. They just happened to have Doki Doki Panic in this stack of games that this Nintendo of America employee had been sent to review. And then the president of NOA at the time, who I believe was a relative of Yamauchi-san, had said, this could be potentially a good Mario game if it was reskinned with the Mario characters. What do you think? And so they went ahead and did it, and that's how Doki Doki Panic came to become Super Mario Brothers 2. I mean, there's a few alterations, just mostly things like obviously the sprite changes, but it already had Starman. It already had the PAL blocks, which came, from original Mario Brothers. And so, a lot of the DNA was already shared with Mario, to the point where I even recall Miyamoto-san, when the team was working on it as Doki Doki Panic, saying, treat this as if it were a Mario game. And so, that sort of level of attention was definitely put into it. And, it had evolved kind of from a prototype of... Kensuke Tanabe-san, who was, the one who was the director of this game, of looking at vertical platforming. So, it definitely kept some of the vertical elements as we think of it, climbing up into, the clouds and stuff. But, so that was a little bit scaled down from what the prototype was. But, definitely when you think about it compared to Super Mario Brothers 1, which is, it did have the little vines that went up into, the clouds or whatever. But, really was more of, just a horizontal platformer, more or less. This game really, kind of made us rethink what platforming could be. And, something else that's really interesting to think about is that in Super Mario Brothers 1, you stepped on enemies, aside from Bowser, to defeat them. And this one involved picking up enemies. But, you know, everything that I've read about, like, you know, people reacting to it is this. At the time, I definitely didn't feel that, like, oh, this is so weird and different. Why is it controlled different? I just was like, wow, it's a new Mario game. I super like it. And that seems to be pretty much the universal, from what I've, like, just reading online reactions of this game.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, like, I have such a soft spot for this game. If I'm in the mood to just, you know, kind of casually play an older Mario game, you know, particularly an NES one, it's usually Super Mario Brothers 2 that I'll go back to, you know. It's really fun. I love that you can play as the different characters. And, you know, that, like, you know, in some levels, like, I always like to choose Peach for the ice levels because her floaty physics kind of make the slippery ice a little bit easier.
I am not surprised to hear that. And can I just say, I basically picked Peach for every level when I was a kid because I just loved that flying ability so much. Like, I mean, it was just fun.
And then we think of, like, you know, Peach being floaty, that's her thing. I mean, I main Peach in Super Smash Brothers, and I love her floaty, and that's, like, you know, that's where it came from. And something else that I always appreciate is that, you know, we got the Shy Guys from Super Mario Brothers 2. What else? There's, like, I feel like there's another big enemy that was huge from, I'm not talking about Wart, you know, poor Wart.
Oh, are you fat shaming Wart right now?
No, I'm just saying that, you know, he hasn't really been super included, but I don't know why I'm having trouble thinking of, oh, Birdo, duh. So, you know, Birdo.
Playable character in the tennis games and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, Birdo, who, you know, is kind of a definitely left of center Nintendo character in terms of the Mario franchise, you know, but she was originally one of the, you know, mini bosses in this game. And then, like I said, Shy Guy, who doesn't love a Shy Guy? I mean, if you don't, then, you know, sorry. But my point being is that despite this not originally being a Mario game, and despite the fact that there hasn't really been quite a sequel to it, truly, I mean, we can argue definitely that its DNA can be felt in other games, and, you know, we'll talk about that as we get to them, but, you know, that it feels like it is a true Mario game, and it is very much deserving of being part of the Mario canon. And, I mean, yeah, definitely, it definitely feels different from the other games, but, you know, I always feel like some people kind of look at it as the black sheep, but, I mean, I really think it's a special game, and from what I remember, I mean, you know, this was the game that helped launch Nintendo Power. The first cover of Nintendo Power was the claymation, or I guess not claymation, but, you know, clay model of Mario pulling up the turnip, and had, like, the information about Super Mario Brothers 2. So, I mean, I seem to remember, like, you know, kids at school, like, really liking it too. So it's kind of interesting to think, to see reactions to it these days, of it being like, oh, it's the black sheep, or, you know, whatever.
All right, so I'm cutting you off because we need to move on, but I just want to say,
I'm sorry, I
love
this
black
game.
Sheep, like, you're sitting here talking about it as if it's not the black sheep. Like, no, I'm sorry, it is. Really, the question is that such a bad thing? And
no.
I would posit no. This game contributed a ton to the Mario canon, as we've discussed here. It has absolutely contributed to the series, to the characterizations, and in a lot of ways paved the way for things to come. Particularly, you know, with that more detailed, more cartoony art style.
Oh, yeah.
Which we did in some ways see come back even as soon as Super Mario Brothers 3.
I mean, I feel
which
like
is
we were
the
talking
next game we're going to talk about.
With Mario 2 and Mario 3, I feel like we were just having a conversation a few weeks ago about, like, man, it's like playing a cartoon.
Well, yeah, especially at the time. I mean, we look at it now and, like, okay, these graphics are somewhat primitive. But at the time, like, this was an unprecedented level of design within each character sprite. You know, so much personality in Mario, like the size of Mario's nose and stuff even. It was just very much, you know, like Mario, when you would do little flippies, if you had a star, the way that he had, like, a like turning around animation if you were running and turn mid stop,
right.
And he had a little couple frames of animation of him, like, stopping his momentum.
You know, I
it
feel
really
like a lot
gave
of people say
so much personality to the characters.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people say, oh, the reason that everyone thinks Mario 3 looks so much better is because they're just mistaking it with the All-Stars version, and I don't agree.
I agree with you. I do not agree with that general sentiment.
I remember at the time being stunned by how great this game looked.
So this game released, and this was the first time we saw, like, a real big gap gap between territories. This released in Japan on October 23rd, 1988. Then in North America, like a year and a half later, February 12th, 1990.
There's a funny story behind that, but we can talk about that later.
And in the PAL regions on August 29th, 1991. This does mean that the next game we're going to talk about released before this in North America, but after it in Japan. And we are using the Japanese timeline for our structure and ordering here.
Aside from Super Mario Brothers 2 USA, Doki Doki. Yeah.
So, Slaggy, I'm going to need you to be a little bit more concise, yes.
Well,
but why don't you start talking now about Super Mario Brothers 3?
So Super Mario Brothers 3 definitely has much more DNA shared with Super Mario Brothers 1 and, you know, Super Mario Brothers 2 Japan Lost Levels than it does with Super Mario Brothers 2 USA Doki Doki Panic. And, you know, it introduced a lot of new things, really. I mean, I could talk about the level design and how, like, you know, just a huge jump forward the level design was. But, you know, you have other things, like there was the overworld map, which definitely is something that we've come to think of with Mario games. A lot more costumes and items, like, you know, the warp whistles kind of, you know, really leveling up the idea of the warp pipes and such. And, you know, like, just different types of enemies, different types of challenges, different types of levels, like, such as the airships, and, you know, still like underwater things and still underground things, but, you know, definitely a lot of variance within the level design.
Absolutely. And, you know, something that I often come for Super Mario Brothers 3,
is that it's not Super Mario World.
I often come for it because I think that people overrate Mario 3 just a hair. I think that this game is incredible, if we're being clear here. And, you know, just looking at it, you can tell Nintendo did so much to make a really special game here. They used, like, special graphics chips in the cartridge that they had never really used before. They did all kinds of stuff with, like, literally including, like, extra RAM in the cartridge to enable, like, diagonal scrolling.
Yeah.
Like, a scan line timer in order to do certain screen effects. Like, they really, it is nuts that they went all out here on a technical level to make this game work. And you know, they gave us the first, like, real Mario flight in the game, like the first Mario power that straight up let him fly and you know, added a whole dimension.
Leaf power up.
Yeah, right, with the raccoon suit or the Tanuki
leaf,
suit.
The leaf power up so much.
Me too. It's iconic, but
it's literally the cover.
Well, yeah, right. It's literally iconic. So, I mean, you know, it's just a really astonishing game, and, you know, it ties into what I was saying about how Mario is fundamentally about running and jumping. The powers in this game, you know, you got, like, the frog suit that changed the way you swim mm-hmm. completely. You got the, you know, the tail that would let you fly and really just explore.
And would let you attack with your tail if you went with, like, a boop.
Well, not what I'm talking about, though. You know, you ended up with a whole new dimension of exploration, both underwater and in the sky. That was,
so
it was
secrets.
Just a whole new level of exploration in the game, because the Mario games, really, even from Mario 1, you know, you would have Super Mario 1, that is, you would have some pipes that you could go down to find new places. You'd have, you know, the hidden warp zones.
Yeah.
So exploration has always been a thing in the Mario games. But to me, Mario 3 was the first time that really stepped to the forefront, where you had every level was, you know, 20, 40 screens long, or wide, I should say, but also two or three screens tall. Mm-hmm. And things could be happening anywhere within this stage, and it was really up to the player, you know, aside from some cues that the game would give you via enemy and coin placement to sort of gently nudge you in the right direction. But for the most part, it was left to the players to find all of this extra cool stuff. And it's really, again, to me, like a real evolution of the ideas and mm-hmm. concepts that have been established from that first Super Mario game. And it's just, to me, it's I have to be honest, you know, I do certainly prefer Super Mario World. I think it's crazy that so many people think Mario 3 is better than Mario World. I'm like, are you effing kidding me here?
I don't think I can say that, but...
But Mario 3 is such an amazing game.
And without Mario 3, Mario World would not have been possible.
If you're somehow listening to this show and you have never played Mario 3, I think you absolutely need to get onto Virtual Console on your 3DS or Wii U or Wii, or hell, download it off a damn ROM website if that's all you got. But play this game. Really, just an absolute landmark in game design, in level design. It was a cultural phenomenon for a reason.
Yeah.
Like, straight up, there's a reason why this game featured in the 1989 movie The Wizard, okay? Like, it's phenomenal. Phenomenal. The way all of the different worlds were distinctly themed differently. You had the desert world, World 2. World 4 was like the giant world.
I love giant worlds so much.
World 7 was like pipes and piranha plants.
And I just want to really quickly say, like, World 7 with like the little platforms that you jumped on and the arrows changed direction. I'm like, hello, like another type of, like just really out of the box thinking.
Absolutely. Just absolutely groundbreaking. And again, you know, in a very real way, other games that came out after this were so deeply influenced. Even games you wouldn't think of really borrowed from even the concept of worlds being grouped together by theme, because that still wasn't something you saw a lot of. So it's just such groundbreaking stuff. So, like, yeah, I know you had more to say about 3, so why don't you get on with it so that we can get on with it?
You really covered a lot, and like I said, really without Mario 3, we wouldn't have had the amazing, possibly flawless game that is Super Mario World, but I wanted to just really quickly touch on the delay. It was because of cartridge shortages that had to do with Super Mario Bros. 2, and it might have also had something to do with the special chips as well. And so that also kind of impacted them, including it in The Wizard. And I specifically remember seeing The Wizard and being like, oh my god, Super Mario Bros. 3 looks so good. So even though The
You're going to be one of my favorite musicians when I grow up.
Oh, right?
Go on.
Even though that movie now is terrible, it worked. I remember that vividly. I would, you know, watch it over and over again just to see the Super Mario Brothers. And, like, you know, it also showed the warp whistle.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, oh, yeah, you got the warp whistle. So, I mean, like, just the fact that you got that secret. And just really quickly, I just wanted to talk about some of the cool secrets in the game, which, you know, you can definitely, like, research and find out more. But, like, the white toad houses, the coin ship, and, I mean, even things like, you know, oh, ducking behind the white platform, which we all think of as, you know, oh, yeah, that's as common as, like, a warp world.
Why don't you explain that? Because there are probably people here listening to this show who don't know what that means.
So, in certain levels, there are, and, you know, the whole aesthetic of Super Mario Bros. 3 kind of looks like it's a set on a play. You know, it has the curtains opening, and the things are, like, bolted onto the background, and I choose to believe that it is canonically them in a play, but I'm just being LOL right now. But, you know, the point being that there's certain of these platforms that you're on that are white as opposed to, you know, other colors. And if you hold down for a while, you will go behind the scenery. And, like, for example, in World 1-3, it'll lead you behind the exit screen into a secret toad house where you get your first warp whistle. So, I mean, even things like that were just, like, just the level of, you know, the level of design that allowed for these secrets. And then, like, you were talking about, you know, with the upward level design and the fact that, oh, if you fly and you fly from this certain point and you run from this certain point, you can get up to this thing, but, oh, you need to carry a Koopa Troopa shell for it so that you can bump this thing and then get the POW block because there's a hidden door here or whatever. I mean, there's just so much in this game that, I mean, really the replayability is just, it's huge because, I mean, Super Mario Bros. 1 is a fun game to replay, but, like, just the scope of Super Mario Bros. 3 is just, I mean, they called it the biggest, most exciting Mario Bros. Adventure yet, and it was definitely true. It was, like, a huge game. The level design was just totally memorable. You know, I can just think back to all the different levels, and, you know, like I said, Giant World I loved, and I didn't love Water World that much, but who did?
I did.
I was making a Water World the movie joke, but
I know that you were, but I like Water World the movie, and I like Water World the world, so
just two other quick things. I love that this just continued the trend of Nintendo designers including elements from their childhood. You know, we talked back in our Pokemon episode about how Satoshi Tajiri-san collected bugs, and that kind of helped inspire Pokemon, and Miyamoto-san himself used to explore caves and stuff and near his house, and that inspired Zelda. But the Chain Chomp that we now think of as another iconic baddie in the Super Mario universe was based on a bad childhood experience that he had with a dog. And I think, is it Chain Chomp called Bow Wow in all Japanese version?
I believe so, yes.
Or is that just in Link's Awakening? So that if you're ever wondering why a Chain Chomp is named Bow Wow in Link's Awakening, or why the Chain Chomp's got to go like, arr, arr, it's because it's meant to be like a rabid dog. And then, of course, the Koopalings, you know, we love them, and you know, they got their start here. We were thrilled that they're back in more recent games. And, you know, the Mario games have never been super, like, story, 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 but, you know, again, there's subtle storytelling going on that, you know, just makes it fun and immersive, and, you know, getting to see more of the Mushroom Kingdom. Just a really, really great game. Another brilliant soundtrack that, you know, is iconic from Koji Kondo-san. Just a fantastic game.
It's interesting you bring up storytelling and the Mushroom Kingdom, because the next game we're going to talk about is the first Mario game not to be set in the Mushroom Kingdom. It's set in Sarasa Land.
Where my people at, Sarasa Land?
And interestingly, this game actually has a lot of firsts. It was the first Mario game not to be made under Shigeru Miyamoto-san's supervision. This one was made by Satoru Okada-san, whom you're probably more familiar with in his directorial role on Metroid.
Right.
He also was the chief director of Kid Icarus, Solar Striker, Mario Land, which is what we're talking about now. So he, you know, actually just retired from Nintendo only about 5 years ago, but he was a lower-profile creator. And basically, Hiroshi Yamauchi-san, whom was the Nintendo CEO of the time, basically wanted, with the launch of the Game Boy, for there to be a Mario game. Miyamoto-san was obviously busy with, you know, Mario Brothers 3 direction at the time, because, you know, there was a little bit of simultaneous development here. But they basically went back and made a Mario Brothers game, Super Mario Brothers game, that, you know, took some cues from the first Super Mario Brothers game. It is a smaller experience, both in terms of character sprites and the game length, and it introduced the new princess, Princess Daisy, who...
Hi, I'm Daisy.
...still to this day has quite a few fans.
And this quite a few many more
resurrected
haters.
The idea of the side-scrolling shooter stages that we talked about that were being discussed in the development
right.
of... you know, the original Super Mario Brothers game. This released in Japan on April 21st, 1989, and it released in North America on August 1989. Super Mario Land is kind of a weird game.
It is. I remember being like, why are there Gradius levels in this Mario game?
And funny enough, there are even Moai heads in this game.
There are. They're not Moai Moais, but I remember being like, what are the Moai heads? Or, you know, I don't know if I knew they were called Moai yet, but, you know, I'm like, what are those Easter Island heads doing there?
Koopa shells would explode rather than throwing fireballs. You threw, like, bouncy balls. You know, some of the one-up mushrooms were replaced with hearts, so there was a lot of sort of breaking from the pre-established formula this game did. But in a really interesting sort of twist, you know, they changed Mario's physics, you know, as we discussed earlier, being such an important part of the game. And for a lot of people, like, this was a really fun game. It was like a really fun side game. We're not really talking about it here as a side game because, you know, I think ultimately the Super Mario series sort of meets around the Nintendo DS era and Mario becomes one coherent series. But at this time, Super Mario Land does feel a little bit more like a spinoff.
Right. And I think a lot of people tend to think of it as inferior, which I think is unfair. You know, it's a different game. It was designed by a different team and, you know, it's for different platforms. So, you know, there was no way it was going to be the same.
Yeah.
Consider like the screen size. And all that, and the technology. I mean, I would say it's not my favorite, but I appreciate it for what it is.
You know, it's, again, that's really what you have to think of. For what it is, I think it's a fantastic game. And, you know, again, you also have to consider that, you know, up until the later days of the Game Boy, a lot of developers were having a hard time squeezing much power out of that thing. And when you really stop and think about the fact that, you know, Super Mario Land and Pokemon Yellow are running on the same hardware, you know, Pokemon Yellow with its amazing, gorgeous sprites, like, that's kind of ridiculous.
Right.
So either way, you know, it's a weird little game, and emphasis on little. There are not very many stages to the game. I think there are, what, like 12, and two of them are side-scrolling shooter stages?
I think that's right.
So it's definitely a little weird, little bit of a weird situation, but it's fun. And that, to me, is the fundamental, like, you know, they took some risks, they made some strange choices, but ultimately it worked out as a portable game. I always thought it was a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
And it's something that, to me, even now, I sometimes will go back to and, like, you know, this game is weird, but it's a really cool alternate take, and I really appreciate it for
that. It's an essential part of understanding the history of the series, and, you know, like you said... you know, it's fun. And something that I always just think about is just the fact that Tetris was, you know, included as the bundle-in game. Originally, it was going to be Super Mario Land, but they decided with Tetris, which, you know, Tetris was huge. It sold tons and tons and tons of Game Boys. And I kind of just can't help but wonder if Tetris being the bundle-in kind of affected, you know, I really think of, like, Super Mario Land being the black sheep.
Well, it certainly helped Tetris in any event.
It's more like green and gray sheep, isn't it?
All right. Anyway, I want to move forward here.
Oh, I know you do.
This game, though, I do want to mention, it is available on the 3DS Virtual Console, and I think it's really cool. I think it's a game that's worth playing, and I think it's worth looking into. But I want to move on to Mario World. This, of course, was sort of the flagship Super Nintendo game, or, you know, Super Famicom, but we're probably going to call it Super Nintendo here.
Yep.
It was one of, what, like, two launch games for the Super Nintendo. I think it was Super Mario World and... In Japan, it was Super Mario World and F-Zero. In North America, there was actually a handful. Super Mario World, F-Zero, Pilot Wings, SimCity, and Gradius 3. So, Super Mario World is a game I could talk about all damn day. You have the introduction of Yoshi, which was a huge deal. You want to talk about altering the way that Mario runs and jumps. You know, this gave Mario effectively like an air jump by jumping off of Yoshi's back midair. It gave, Yoshi had the ability to eat turtle or Koopa shells and then spit them out.
Yep.
If you ate a turtle shell that was of a red color, a blue color, or a yellow color, Yoshi would be able to either fly, shoot fireballs out of his mouth, or cause, like, little earthquakes when he would land. So, I mean, Yoshi really had a lot of abilities that really augmented what Mario could do. This game, in a lot of ways, builds on the groundwork laid in Super Mario Bros. 3. Before I get ahead of myself, it released in Japan, Super Famicom, November 21st, 1990, North America, August 23rd, 1991, the EU regions, April 11th, 1992, and Australia, July 1st, 1992.
And a little fun tidbit, in Australia, it was published by Mattel.
Oh, fun! So, you know, on a fundamental level, Super Mario World, it does build off of Super Mario Bros. 3. It had a ton of hidden exits. That was like the big deal of this
Which is
game.
Captain Spike's favorite thing ever.
Oh, for sure. Basically, ton of the levels on the world map, they're denoted by having a red entry icon rather than a yellow one. And that basically means that the level had two different exits. So you would play through the level, you'd find the first exit, and then if you're the kind of player who's like me, you would then go back into the level and search high and low in order to find these sometimes very tricky secret exits, which would open up, you know, new paths on the overworld map. And sometimes if you found one of the particularly difficult secret exits, you would unlock a whole separate, like, hub world called the Star Road.
Star World.
And the Star Road was where they put all of the, like, Super Mario Brothers 4 Super Players style levels.
Oh, man. Some of those Star Worlds are crazy.
Oh, yeah. Those Star World levels are ridiculous. Some of the, you know, they all are named after, like, various different, like, adjectives and, like, 90s catchphrases. So you have, like, tubular and awesome.
Yes.
And they are tubular and awesome. You know, the new flying ability was sort of a riff on the raccoon tail that would let you fly, except this time it was a feather that gave you a cape.
Yeah.
And the cape was interesting because the cape added a sort of bit of manual dexterity requirement in order to properly fly.
Which I've never been that good at, but you're super good at.
Yeah, you would get the same basic, like, lift and fly that you would get from the raccoon tail, but then after that, Mario would go into, like, a slower sort of fall that you could, if you rocked the controller back and forth and built momentum, you could actually, like, start raising into the air again, start building momentum, going faster and faster, and, you know, even potentially end up raising higher than your initial burst of flight would take you. And, you know, this is actually something that is expected of you and leveraged if you really want to get all of the game's hidden exits. Mm-hmm. Though it is worth mentioning that through using Yoshi and using his various, you know, different turtle shell ability or Koopa shell abilities, you can get around a lot of the trickier flight movement situations and puzzles. So
right.
It's just, it's to me, the reason why Super Mario World is so effective is it basically takes the best ideas from Mario Brothers, from Mario Brothers 2 and Mario Brothers 3, 2 in this case meaning Lost Levels, and it really puts them all together. It gives you, like, the straightforward play, start to exit of Mario Brothers 1. From Mario Brothers Lost Levels, you get, like, the really tricky stuff, the super tricksy stuff, where the game is throwing, like, obvious, like, wrong information at you, and the game expects you to figure out, like, no, the game is tricking me because this really goes against the way that this level is designed. And it expects you to keep up and be thinking about level design, which to me is just, it's so interesting.
This door in this ghost house actually isn't a door. It'll
right?
just disappear when you try to use it.
And then from Super Mario Brothers 3, you have that sort of exploration element that I was talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Where the game really encourages you to, you know, fly through every level to go through every level straightforward, jumping and running, to take Yoshi through every level and see what Yoshi can do. And it really, and just, it encourages you to play this game however you want, while also giving you, like, entry-level challenges, max-level challenges, and everything in between. To me, I really feel like Super Mario World is the perfect distillation of what Nintendo was trying to do with Super Mario as a series all along.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, why don't you talk about your feelings and thoughts on Super Mario World.
I wanted to touch on a couple of things to add. The first one being something that was indeed, you know, also part of Super Mario Brothers 3, which was if you play two player, that, you know, you would take turns clearing the worlds, and so, you know, that made it definitely a lot more fun in terms of replayability, rather than Super Mario Brothers 1, where, you know, the second player would have to just, you know, clear those same levels. So that was something that, you know, is always cool. It's like, oh, you know, like, you go in through and just do the regular levels, and then I'll go through and get the hidden ones. Well, I would be the one doing the just straightforward one, and Captain Spike would be getting the secrets, which is, like, basically how we play when we play together. But also, with the switches, you know, also just adding a brand new elements to levels, like, oh, you couldn't cross this path or something before because there were you didn't have the right switch, but now you can. So just, like, that level of replayability as well, just really, again, like, the replayability and then just all the secrets, too, just make it such a great game. Like, again, the way the game controls, you know, with the Super Nintendo, Super Famicom, like, even better platforming experience. I can't praise this game enough. It's really, it's probably one of the best games ever created. You know, no matter how amazing or advanced games will get, the music, again, Koji Kondo, another iconic soundtrack. And I could talk about this one for hours too.
Yeah, me too. This for me is the Mario game about which I'm probably most passionate. But, you know, again, in the interest of keeping things moving, I don't have a ton of interesting development anecdotes about this that I've read over the years.
Just that,
other
you
than
know,
Miyamoto-san, you know, he'd actually wanted Yoshi in the game from literally the
right.
very first Super Mario Brothers, but, you know, they were never able to get that working on the limited hardware of, you know, the NES/Famicom, but they were able to get it to work on the SNES, so they, you know, we finally got our Yoshi.
And also that
this game was also directed by Takashi
Tezuka-san.
You're probably more familiar with Tezuka-san. You know, he did Devil World, which only released in Japan. He did Legend of Zelda Link to the Past. He did Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening. He did work on, you know, Mario 2 Lost Levels and the original Legend of Zelda and Super Mario Brothers 3. So this guy has like a real Nintendo pedigree. And, you know, he's someone that we still talk about here on Gamebuie for, you know, his work on things like Yoshi's New Island, Super Mario Maker, Yoshi's Woolly World.
Oh, yeah, he's a big deal. And
yeah, Tezuka-san is a big deal. And this was, you know, for a lot of us, I think, our first real awareness of Tezuka-san.
Before then, he was just Little Ten-Ten, kind of a...
That was his actual nickname. Slaggy isn't just being, like, diminishing right now. So, anyway, I want to move forward to the next Game Boy game in the series, because this one took a lot of cues from Super Mario World, actually. And it is, in fact, one of the largest games in terms of cartridge space on the Game Boy platform.
And just, man, so, go ahead.
So this is Super Mario Land 2, released in Japan October 21st, 1992, released North America November 2nd, 1992, released in the EU regions January 28th, 1993, and it was directed by Hiroji Kiyotake-san. Kiyotake-san had worked on a couple of games before this, mostly in, like, design roles, but then he got his first director role with Metroid 2 Return of Samus.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you know, he went on to do the Super Mario Land 2 Six Golden Coins. And from there, he actually kept on working on Wario games, including his role as director on Virtual Boy Wario Land, which, you know, I just talked about last week, how to me, it's really a groundbreaking game. So, going back to Mario Land 2, we have here, this is a game that a lot of people, when they played it blew their minds.
Yeah, you know, leaps and bounds above Super Mario Land 1.
Whereas Mario Land 1 feels like a downgrade of the Super Mario 1 design, this feels not really like a downgrade. This feels like a game on the level of, like, Super Mario World meets Super Mario 3.
Definitely. You know, there were even secret exits, right?
Yeah, the game had secret exits. It had an overworld map. It had, you know, boss levels. It really played like a full-scale Mario 3, Mario World style game. You had new abilities, like the magic carrot that turned Mario into a bunny that would let him, like...
Yeah. Yes.
Jump higher and, like, air float, very similar to how, like, the Super Leaf worked in Mario 3. And the game played, again, very much like a Mario 3 or Mario World game. It's to me, an absolute, like, hidden gem, because I know a lot of people to this day who have never played Mario Land 2 thinking it would be, like, the first Mario Land, and it's not. It's a real Mario game.
I also love that you could go in any order of the world. Did you have to do the first world first or something? And then
I believe you did, but then there was a little bit of Mega Man style, like, you could go do a different world as you choose after that.
And I remember one of them took place in, like, a toy Mario that you still see, like, elements of it, like with the clockwork level of Mario Kart 8.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a phenomenal game. Absolutely worth playing even in 2015. I don't have a lot to say about it. You know, the direction, actually, the development went very straightforwardly. Kazumi Totaka-san,
yes,
whom obviously you're probably familiar with. He did the music. And, you know, a lot of people at the end of the Game Boy's life cycle, a lot of people called Mario Land 2, like, one of the best of all the Game Boy games. Like, many people were, you know, top 3, top 4, top 5, including Super Mario Land 2. So it's absolutely worth playing, even today. I highly recommend it. And it is available on the 3DS Virtual Console, so I would recommend you check it out.
And yes, it does have Totaka-san in it.
Of course. The next game I want to talk about here is one that is commonly known as Yoshi's Island. But, strictly speaking, its full title is Super Mario World 2 Yoshi's Island.
Yep.
This was released in Japan in August 1995, and released in North America and the EU regions in October 1995. Slaggy, do you want to kick us off here?
Yeah, so Super Mario World 2 Yoshi's Island is a prequel to... Well, it's a prequel to Super Mario World, but also presumably to other ones as well, if you really care about, like, the continuity.
Mario lore.
The Mario continuity, where Yoshi helps, or, you know, different Yoshis help baby Mario get through different levels. Visually, just such a groundbreaking game. It had a beautiful hand-drawn levels, which very interestingly were... had the roots in the fact that Miyamoto-san hated the way that Donkey Kong Country used, like, pre-rendered, so he very specifically wanted this game to have, you know, a very hand-drawn, soft aesthetic that, you know, kind of really fit with the babbies of the game. And, you know, also using the Super FX2 chip that was...
Yeah, lots of sprite scaling effects and stuff. It was very cool tech. Something interesting is, you know, because of the Super FX2 chip, either for emulation purposes or licensing purposes, no one's really quite sure. This is actually a hard game to get in 2015. The best bet you have is probably either the Wii U Virtual Console release of the Game Boy Advance port.
Yeah.
Which was released as Yoshi's Island Super Mario Advance 3, or the Ambassador Program exclusive 3DS download of the GBA port. The actual SNES/Super Famicom version has not received any kind of port or update to date, which is a real shame because the game really shines in its original presentation. Game is beautiful. The mechanics, you know, giving Yoshi his sort of trademark throwing eggs. It's real interesting stuff. The hand-drawn paper crayon aesthetic is beautiful in its original presentation.
Yeah, and I mean, I would argue really paved the way for things like not only Paper Mario, but things like, you know, some of the Kirby titles we talked about.
Sort of the canvas curse and the claymation that we see in
and even like
that
Epic
one.
Yarn.
Oh, absolutely.
Sorry, Woolly World. You know, just the idea of using like these different textures and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So according to Miyamoto-san, the game was in development for 4 years.
Wow.
Which is, to me, nuts. Obviously, you know, they used Argonaut Games' Super FX2 chip in order to power it, as we were discussing. Argonaut Games, obviously, you might be familiar with for their work on Star Fox, which used the original Super FX chip. So it's a really interesting...
I believe Argonaut has an interesting story with 64, right? But we'll get to that in a couple minutes.
Yeah, we will get to that. So anyway, this game, it's fantastic. This is sort of where we see the sort of start of what is typically known as like the collect-a-thon playstyle. Every level in Mario World 2 Yoshi's Island has like various coins you need to collect, various flowers you need to collect, various stars you need to collect.
Was this the first Red Coins game?
It's not the first game in which the Red Coins were introduced, but it is the first game in which they were like a specific collectible that the game would tally how many you found rather than just get 8 and get a life or whatever.
Right. That's what I thought.
So, and you know, the game actually had like a secret ending with like every level, every world even getting like extra levels unlocked if you would do all of the collectibles and really go all out. And that's something that we'd see revisited, you know, time and again in the Mario series moving forward, where you would get rewards for collecting everything and doing everything. This game is super popular both for its really exploration-based 2D level design and its incredible art style. It's absolutely worth playing in 2015, and I highly, highly, highly recommend that you find a way to play the SNES original version.
Mm-hmm.
If all you can do is play the GBA port via Virtual Console, you know, you got to do what you got to do. But
hey, if you can find an SNES and...
If you can find an SNES or maybe, you know...
one of those things that, like, plays SNES games.
You know, like your computer.
No, I know, but, like, you know...
No, I know that you're talking about, like, a Retron, but to me, straight up, Nintendo needs to get off the ass and release this, and until they do, I do not blame anyone who wants the full, real Yoshi's Island experience, because that GBA port, while, you know, it's good, I mean, certainly for what the game that they were porting, it's the best you could have done, but you can't appreciate how incredible this game is via that port. I'm sorry.
Right, because, I mean, by the time GBA rolled around, it was like, oh, it's a cute GBA game, look at that.
Well, and again, you know, the graphics suffered, the presentation suffered, to some degree the level design suffered because the aspect ratio of the GBA screen was different than what you would have seen on a TV. It's just not, to me, it's not the same experience, and that original experience is one that is worth having. That's beginning and end for me.
So can I say a few things about Yoshi's Island?
You can, but keep it
moving. I'm
going to
keep it quick. I love that this game was basically like a passion project for Miyamoto-san. You know, we talked about how he did not like Donkey Kong Country at all. In fact, at the time when he first presented it to... When he first presented Yoshi's Island to the marketing department at Nintendo, they were like, no, it doesn't look as good as Donkey Kong Country. And he apparently said, Donkey Kong Country proves that players will put up with mediocre gameplay as long as the art is good. Burn.
Sick burn, girl.
And also the decision to make Yoshi the hero of the game. And I really feel like for a while, Yoshi was really kind of pegged as like the next Mario, was because he did not like Yoshi's Safari and Yoshi's Cookie at all. And he wanted to make something a lot more authentic. So, it's
and
just...
why don't you tell our listeners what those two games are?
So Yoshi's Safari is...
It's a Super Scope 6 game.
It's a Super Scope game. It's...
Why don't you tell our listeners what the Super Scope is?
It's the gun for the Super Nintendo.
You mean the light gun, like light accessory? Gun,
yes. Yes, like the zapper. And then Yoshi's Cookie is a puzzle game. And, you know, neither of them are, like, the trashiest trash that ever trashed. But, you know, I can definitely see how, you know, Miyamoto-san was very protective of Mario, you know, to the point where, you know, after the Super Mario Brothers movie came out, you know, there's a reason why we stopped seeing adaptations. But, you know, I really, there's like a lot of like kind of almost spite behind this game. And, you know, the fact that that fueled this like very soft and gentle, but also, you know, really innovative game. It's just, it's very interesting because we, you know, we typically don't really think of Miyamoto-san as being like vengeful and stuff, but, you know, he was throwing some
shade.
Well,
it pops up time and again. If you really look, you know, most of our Miyamoto-san stories are about how kind and gentle and generous he is. But, you know, we have just as many stories of him, you know, upending tea tables
yes.
while shouting at employees. And really, he's a very passionate, driven man, and he has never been one to shy away from showing someone when they're wrong.
Indeed.
And in a lot of ways, you know, Yoshi's Island was a passion project to say, you know, the dedication, the devotion, the mindless sort of acceptance of graphics over gameplay were something that he could not abide. And I think that you can really tell that this game, you know, it's easy to say it's an act of vengeance, a labor of revenge or you know, proving a point, but it was really a passion project to show
yeah.
the importance of gameplay and level design.
And I mean, you see that today with Nintendo choosing, you know, gameplay and fun and, you know, making sure everyone's enjoying themselves over graphics.
Do you have anything else to say about this game? Because we've already reached the point where I wanted to be done recording.
Oh,
and
so
we
you
still
mean
got
we're
like
past
six
the two,
games.
We're past the 2 hour mark, is what you're saying.
Well, it'll edit down less than that, but yes, we are.
All right, let's move it.
All right, well then, the next game I want to talk about is a game that changed the world. This was the Nintendo 64 launch title, Super Mario 64. What?
It changed the Mushroom Kingdom, too.
Girl.
Into 3D!
This released in Japan for the Nintendo 64 on June 23rd, 1996. Released in North America on September 26th, 1996. And released in the EU regions on March 1st, 1997. It also, as an aside, released in China on November 21st, 2003. As the, like, sort of primary game for Nintendo's IQ player.
Yeah.
So... this was, of course, the first Nintendo's first 3D platformer. You know,
they pretty much knocked it out of the park.
Well, yeah, we say, you know, it's their first 3D platformer. It's easy to forget the fact that before Nintendo took this stab at this game, 3D platforming hadn't really been done yet. You know, I mean, like, people were trying but flailing. This was the first game where everyone sort of unanimously agreed, like, this is how you design a 3D platformer. Like, this game is finally working in 3D. You know, there were some issues with the camera,
yeah.
but to me, they're very minor. Like, we hadn't even gotten to the point of, like, having camera problems before this game, because literally people were only doing 3D, like Crash Bandicoot style. Like, you are going down a tunnel, go forward. Not entirely dissimilar to how graphics were done in a game, almost like a Star Fox style, where you know, the camera's always behind you, you're always moving forward, and you know,
I mean, if we're gonna talk about cameras, can we talk about like tank controls and stuff too? Because
no, there's no need for that conversation here. You're just bitter about tank controls.
Yes,
so,
I am.
So you know, in a fundamental way, Nintendo, who wrote the book on how to design a platformer in the first place, wrote the book again, only this time on how to design a 3D adventure exploration platforming game. And it's you know, it's so amazing. Miyamoto-san, who directed this game, alongside, you know, like Yoshiaki Koizumi-san and, you know, some of the other Nintendo legendaries, you know, his goal was really to use the power of the Nintendo 64 to create, like, a whole world around Mario with which to explore. And, you know, they wanted to include, you know, so much detail in the world that you could see it as, like, a little miniature world, the analog that he often described it being to miniature trains. And, you know, he wanted, you know, the characters and the enemies all to sort of communicate emotions. So, like, the boos are sort of based on Tezuka-san's wife.
Yes.
Miyamoto-san explained in a very kind of sexist way, but, you know, she was apparently normally very quiet, but she would sometimes explode at Tezuka-san when he spent too much time at work. So he designed the boo, you know, like when Mario is looking at the boo, he's timid and shy, and as soon as Mario looks away, it actually grows in size now and begins stalking you.
Right.
And it's, to me, it's just, it really speaks to the level of care and love in this game. I recently replayed through Mario 64. I did a complete 120 star run, and it just really, really even still stands out that there are just so many cute little touches, things that even doing a 120 star playthrough, you could so easily miss. Just all kinds of cute things, all kinds of little hidden things. Obviously, you know, the level designs were so intuitive and so playable that, you know, that's how we all learned how to play 3D games. People
right.
who make 3D games learned how to make them by playing this. It is, to me, absolutely a landmark game, and to me, one of the best games Nintendo has ever made. Slaggy, what do you have to say about Mario 64?
No, I totally agree. I mean, it really brought Mario into the 3D sphere, and I feel like a lot of people will say, oh, there's 2D Mario, and then there's 3D Mario, but, I mean, this really, of course, a Mario in a 3D sphere was going to change it radically, but I mean, you're still running and jumping, you're still exploring. It has a lot of shared DNA with Super Mario World, with, like, you know, the fact that you're going into the, you have to go into the paintings multiple times to get all the stars that you need, you know, so that, you know, this time you're exploring a completely different path, or you're going down this tunnel because that's where you have to go to get this star, which, I mean, just really, you know, made the took the exploration to a whole new level. And just, it's a very cute game too. I mean, all the Mario games are cute, but I think of, like, the little pink Bob-ombs that are, like, the Bob-omb buddies that help you out. It's just, like, very cute because, you know, they were definitely able to convey a lot more with, you know, the technology, and, you know, you definitely see that, and sometimes, like, derided because that Nintendo's too cutesy, but I mean, whatever, you know, like, I love the little pink Bob-ombs, like, and the fact that the game could, like, you know, really convey that more than, you know, maybe a little pink Bob-omb in a Super Nintendo game might have or something.
And, you know, this game actually introduced several, you know, grinding and jumping abilities that
wall
absolutely
jumping.
Have stuck with the Mario canon. And, you know, Slaggy, you mentioned wall jumping, which is one of the big ones, but you also had the backflip.
Uh-huh.
You had, you know, the triple jump where, you know, you get the one, a two, and, you know, that third jump is like a big flippy jump that can, you know, cover tons of ground, get you way higher in the level design. And, you know, you had the long jump, which you also see in a lot of the newer 3D games. It's just really, in so many ways, right out of the gate, Nintendo codified so much of what 3D Mario is.
Yeah,
immediately. I mean, it was like born fully formed.
And I think what really speaks highly of Super Mario 64 is the fact that what we see with the other 3D platforming Marios is that, you know, there's definitely new ground broken, which is, you know, why I think that, you know, these games continue to be hugely influential and, you know, pushing new territory. But the fact that the groundwork for it really was laid in this game, you know, the way that coins work in the 2D and the 3D platforming world. And, you know, the way that, you know, enemies work and just, you know, the controls and such, you know, that even though they have iterated on it and refined things and taken them to amazing new places, that really, like, when you go back, because I watched Captain Spike playing 64 and then playing Galaxy, like, right after it, or with Galaxy 2 it might have been, and just really being like, wow, you know, really just appreciating how much it's still oh, is Super Mario 64.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, again, you know, this is a game I could do a whole episode on just Mario 64. But since we're doing more than that here, it's time to move on.
Can I share the quick tidbit that's interesting about Argonaut?
If you'd like.
Just that Argonaut had been working on a game titled Super Mario FX with the, you know, we were talking about the Super FX chip, and that, you know, I guess their relationship kind of ended up souring with Nintendo, and originally they were helping work on a 3D Yoshi platformer, and that game ended up becoming Croc, Legend of the Gobbos. And, yeah, so I think that between Croc and Super Mario 64, I think we all know which one was the best.
Yeah.
Also, who doesn't love Mips?
Oh, Mips, the bunny.
Yes.
So, we didn't get another mainline Mario game for several years.
That's true.
But, you know, eventually the Nintendo 64 faded away and the new platform came out, the Nintendo GameCube. And with it, in Japan, July 19th, 2002. North America, August 26th, 2002. So, you know, starting to see that window close up a bit. The EU territories, October 4, 2002. And Australia, October 11th, 2002. We saw the release of what is probably the most controversial of the Mario series.
So controversial.
Super Mario Sunshine.
Amazing game.
Now, I spoke a little bit earlier about my base thought on Super Mario Sunshine, which ties into, you know, the comments made about how, you know, on a fundamental level, Super Mario Sunshine is about augmenting the way Mario runs and jumps. When you really look at it, you really break it down, it is fundamentally, you know, it's easy to get caught up. This is the game where Mario has the water device on his back.
Flood.
You have to wash away graffiti off the walls.
Are you being dismissive of Flood?
On a fundamental way, it's easy to dismiss it as being about that silly device. But if you really think about it, what that device does is fundamentally augment a core gameplay mechanic that up to this has been in play for 15 years.
Thank you.
What?
No, just I thought at first you were being dismissive of Flood.
No, not at all.
And also, if y'all know what I'm talking about and you've played through the game.
Feelsy?
Yeah.
So moving on, you know, this game, once again, we didn't really mention it about Mario 64, but Mario 64 is basically you're going through various paintings to collect shines, which are stars. There were 120 of them in that game, but you only needed, what, like 70 to fight Bowser at the end of the game.
So don't get Bowser.
You have a very similar setup in Super Mario Sunshine. You're again collecting shines. They're called shine sprites in this game. Really funny, when you get them in the North American version, it would say, like, you got a shine. But in Japan, it would literally just say, shine get. Which I actually still to this day use that phrasing all the time.
Yes, you do.
Like, I'll be like, if I grab a soda, I'll be like, soda get.
You do.
You know, what have you. So anyway, you know, this game, to me, the cool thing about Sunshine is that because you have Flood, which is fundamentally augmenting your abilities, gives you effectively like a super jump or like a hover jump, you know, gives you some actual like offensive capabilities.
Yeah.
You know, the game actually ends up becoming a lot more varied. You have some levels which are just straight up like platform as fast as you can. Some levels that are like scale the mountain using your super jumps. You know, some of them it's like get on a turtle shell and surf on it and then do super jumps off of the back of the turtle shell. You know, it just really gave the designers so many more opportunities and options to really challenge players and give players like really interesting and different for Mario sort of worlds to explore, things to find, secrets to conquer. It's just, to me, a very special game. I know that, again, it is largely hated. I'm sure...
I don't get it.
We may even have tweets negative about this game, but I hope not. I think better of y'all. But this game gets shat on a lot, and I don't get it. I think that
it is
fully realized, really cool experience. Takes, you know, you have the whole like beach setting, Delfino Plaza.
You gotta love the, what are they called? Are they just called the Delfinos? Or
the Piantas?
Piantas, yes.
You know, and yeah, they're big, happy guys. Lots of smiles in this game. It's a very pleasant game. Lots of cool ideas. I can't really speak highly enough about it. Really took advantage of the fact that the GameCube controller has analog triggers. So, like, putting a different amount of pressure on the trigger, you would shoot your water out at different pressures. It's just very cool to me. I thought it was very neat. And this, to me, is a must play. Again, I think it's a fantastic game. So, Maggie, what do you have to say about Sunshine?
Yeah, just touching on what you were saying about the fact that it gets so much hate, I don't get it. It's so fun. I mean, you know, all the Mario games are fun, or I wouldn't be playing them, but... I mean, I feel like I could just, you know, platform around and use Flood and, like, go like, whoosh and stuff, you know, to get places with the different settings on Flood, you know.
It's well, it gives you so many traversal options, and so many of them are just fun to execute.
It's just so fun.
To me, when a game has a traversal mechanic that is fun, another game I'd look at would be, like, the... Square Enix revival of Tomb Raider. If you can make your traversal fun, you've basically, in my eyes, already won the battle. Because if one of the hardest things for me to do in a game, like, let's say Zelda Ocarina of Time, is going from point A to point B, where literally all you can do is, like, run and maybe do, like, your little tumble, and you're just like, and that's, like, you know, 4 hours of your gameplay is just spent running around, being bored, rolling everywhere rolling everywhere because it's maybe a slight bit faster.
Yeah.
If you can give me a traversal mechanic where I'm having fun super jumping and long jumping and hover jumping, to me, you've already cracked, like, the core game for me. Like, you've already given me something I'm gonna like. And for me, Sunshine meets that criteria. I will never understand the hate the game gets.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
it's one that I all the time am wishing would get, like, an HD remaster.
Oh, yeah, that would not, no pun intended, shine in HD. And, you know, the thing is, like, you know, a lot of the camera issues were fixed. And then just the fact that, you know, the storytelling was really cute, you know, again... building on, like, you know, the cute characters of 64, you know, there were, like, little silly little cinema moments, you know, like, the puzzles really, you know, just being really, you know, fun and innovative, you know, definitely with 64 moving more in, like, a puzzle-solving direction than, you know, just, like, platform, but...
There were also some stupendous levels that took Flood away from you and gave you Mario 64-style controls.
Right.
And just gave you some brutal, tough-as-nails level design, and it was just like, you start at point A, you need to get to point B, you need to do it fast, and we are coming for you.
Mm-hmm.
And those levels really sang and, to me, highlighted why Flood was cool, because, you know, it was cool to have these really tight levels that really gave you a very cool objective. I would never give those up. Those areas were a highlight, but they wouldn't have been a highlight without the fun and fancy free sort of
right
exploration and fun traversal of the rest of the game.
Uh-huh.
To me, it's like the two parts that make a great whole.
And, you know, the thing that's really interesting is that it was pretty commercially and critically successful. So I don't get why fans seem to not care for it. I mean, even though this might seem low, it's got a 92 on Metacritic, which, you know, still means universal acclaim. You know, maybe not like the 98, 99, 100 that some of the other Mario games I'm sure would have. But, you know, still like most of the GamePro gave it a perfect score. You know, like just... even Famitsu gave it, you know, 37 out of 40, which is pretty good. So haters gonna hate.
Indeed. So 4 years later, we got our next mainline Mario installment, this time on the Nintendo DS platform in the form of New Super Mario Brothers. Now, it's interesting to think, you know, we went from the Game Boy to the DS in this conversation. That's because while the Game Boy Advance did have three or four Mario Brothers games, they were all like...
Remakes
of earlier iterations of the Mario series.
Like Super Mario 2, Super Mario 3.
Super Mario World.
And Yoshi's Island, I think, right?
And those Yoshi's Island, yeah. Were there really that many? Holy moly.
Yeah, I think those were in that order, too.
Wow. Well, so anyway, New Mario Brothers was a return to the 2D style Mario game, but it was, you know, still done in 3D. So 3D on the DS was kind of a sometimes precarious thing. A lot of us were very worried when this game was announced. We didn't think the game would move as fluidly, the control would be as tight as, you know, the classic 2D style Mario game. But I think most of us ended up being very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
New Mario Brothers was a huge, phenomenal success. The game sold big numbers. It reviewed super well. Enough to the point that the New Super Mario Brothers almost became like another branch series of the game.
Right.
This released in North America on May 15th, 2006. Actually, the first place it released worldwide. Released in Canada May 17th, a few days later. Released in Japan May 25th, 2006. So, you know, 10 days later. Australia got it June 8th. The EU territory territories got it June 30th. Korea got it March 8th, 2007, and then it released in China on July 6th, 2009. It is available on the Wii U Virtual Console, interestingly enough, both in Japan and North America, and not yet in the PAL territories, although it has been confirmed that it will be releasing there at some point. Wii U just started getting DS Virtual Console games, you know, earlier this year, so it's not surprising that it hasn't released everywhere yet. The game, it's a well-designed 2D Mario game, sort of goes back in terms of level design to Mario 1 style, in terms of being a little bit more, you know, point A to point B, not as much exploration focused, but, you know, a real focus on some of Mario's 3D moves. So, you know, the stuff like the triple jump and the wall jump that we were talking about, bringing back like PD Piranha from Super Mario Sunshine, and really codifying to the 2D canon a lot of the stuff that started in the 3D games.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a really cool game. I think it's worth playing, but really I think pretty much all of these games are worth playing. Slaggy, why don't you give us a little bit on
Just
your
really
thoughts?
Quickly, I mean, you've really summed it up nicely. I think it just really proved that there is still a place for 2D platformers, and
the missing piece of this conversation is that we're not talking about Nintendo at large right now, but there was in the 64 and GameCube eras, like a real strong focus from Nintendo on taking everything 3D. So it was really interesting to see them go from 3D back to a 2D style of gameplay.
Right. I mean, I really showed that there was still a place for this type of game, and I would argue, because this was 2006, right?
This was 2006, as we said, yeah. Right around the same time as the release of the Nintendo DS Lite.
Right. And I feel like that was kind of the start of, you know, a lot of... DS domination, definitely. But really just kind of this whole retro revival that we've seen, you know? These days, I mean, like, look at all the different 2D platforming experiences you can have, and some of them are, like, really creative and innovative. So I really credit New Super Mario Brothers for really showing that it still has a place.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to start getting these segments a little shorter. So do you have anything else to say here?
No, because I know we have a lot to say about Galaxy.
Well, yeah, and that's the next game up. So this is the Wii release, Super Mario Galaxy. It was released in Japan November 1st, 2007. Came out in North America, you know, not too long after, November 12th. EU territories, November 16th. And Australia, November 29th, 2007, for all of them. So, really cool. It released worldwide the same month. Definite progress there. This one is also available in Japan only at the moment on the Wii U eShop, as a virtual console Wii game. So very cool. Kind of pisses me off that it's not available as a download in North America yet, but my fingers are crossed that we'll get it. And this basically takes the basic gameplay of Mario 64 and expands it so that Mario, rather than going through paintings, is exploring differently themed little worlds. He's once again going after, you know, stars or shines, I'm sorry. And, you know, it's just each world is like its own complete little experience, completely different aesthetic, oftentimes unique gameplay mechanics. It's an amazing experience. The graphics are off the chain, like just such good graphics, despite being on the Wii, which was not known to be a powerhouse.
Beautiful game.
It is such a beautiful game, and to me really exemplifies the value of art design over like raw processing power.
And the soundtrack, oh my god.
Yeah, fantastic soundtrack.
It's astonishingly amazing game is all I can really say.
Yeah, it's like, why don't you talk a little bit about Mario Galaxy? Like, for me, I'm almost struggling to call out specific things because literally every part of this game is like an A+ to me. Like this, I often cite Galaxy alongside Mario World is like the core Mario games, like some of the core game experiences in the entire history of gaming to me.
Well, I have three big points that I want to hit on. The first being that the origin of Galaxy came from the tech demo that, if you're an older folk like us here on Game Buoy, you might remember the tech demo Super Mario 128 from Space World 2000 that meant to kind of show off the GameCube's power. And, you know, it showed Mario kind of running around on a little spherical platform. And at the time, Yoshiaki Koizumi-san said that he felt that that would be impossible to achieve technically. And then basically after EAD Tokyo finished development on Donkey Kong Jungle Beat, Miyamoto-san's like, I want to make this happen. So they spent 3 months on the physics engine, and that they decided, oh, you know, this would really make sense in an outer space environment, focusing on gravity. And so that's really how it came to be, you know, and then it just developed from there. And so, I mean, I think that's really interesting that it had the roots all the way back from the GameCube, which we often see, you know, like with Yoshi having the roots back in, wanted to be in the original Mario. And, you know, secondly, just that, as you said, this really is kind of like, especially since we haven't seen really a follow-up to Galaxy, aside from Galaxy 2, you know, which definitely built on it, but we haven't seen the true follow-up to Galaxy yet, I feel. And so really, it does feel like kind of like the pinnacle of Mario so far. And it's like, where could they possibly go next?
Well, and you know, when Super Mario 3D World was announced, it got a lot of flack, actually, for not being
Super Mario Universe.
Yeah, or quote, just, you know, whatever people are expecting of the new 3D Mario. Just because, again, like you say, for so many people, Mario Galaxy is, and, you know, I include myself among those in a big way, Mario Galaxy is already, like, in so many ways, like, the pinnacle of design, that we just want to know, like, where can they even go from here?
Right, and I use Mario Galaxy as an example of, like, you know, a game that really it iterates but also innovates. And, like, I even in Nintendo's own, you know, series of games, that's not always true. And then my third point is, yes, Rosalina!
Oh, that's right. Rosalina, sort of the third Mario princess. No, but, you know, Rosalina has a huge fandom, as you can see from the fact that she's already been in Mario Kart. She's a top-tier character in Smash Brothers. Like, Daisy ain't in Smash Brothers.
Hey, now, there's a Daisy color scheme for Peach.
Oh, a Daisy color scheme for Peach. You think that's just as good. All right. Anyway, let's move this forward.
I don't want to take my Peach play with that.
Let's talk about the other Wii Mario Brothers game. This is New Super Mario Brothers Wii, which, as you can probably tell, is the sort of direct sequel to New Super Mario Brothers for DS. This is, you know, very similarly a 2D platformer, but taking some of the cues from, like, Super Mario 3, Super Mario World. It yep. introduced, like, a new flying ability. This was a propeller on Mario's hat that let him fly and do more exploration. The game started focusing on, you know, multiple exits again, finally, having hidden secrets and really focusing on sort of where 2D Mario ended up. You know, if I said, you know, New Super Mario Brothers was like a callback to Mario 1, this is a callback to, like, Mario 3 and World. And probably more 3 than World. But it's just, you know, it's to me a fantastic game, and I don't really think it's coincidental that this game sold ridiculously. As of earlier this year, the game was at just shy of 30 million units sold.
Yeah, like, huge.
It is the second best-selling Mario game on the Wii, behind Mario Kart Wii, which was at, like, 35 million. And, you know, it had some music by Koji Kondo. A lot of people feel like the new Super Mario game's aesthetic is weak, that the graphics aren't as charming, the music is not as interesting. I don't know that I agree with that completely, but I definitely think that it's a fantastic game. I think the levels are well designed. I think it's a lot of fun. If you're looking to visit New Super Mario Brothers gameplay on console, I don't think I'd recommend you play this one, but we'll get to why that is in just a minute. This released in Australia November 11th, 2009, North America November 15th, 2009, the EU territories November 20th, 2009, and in Japan last on December 3rd, 2009. Slaggy, do you have anything to say about this one?
You know, just that, you know, I appreciate that it has been outshined by some other ones. I mean, specifically you, but I mean, it has four-player co-op.
That's you.
Four-player co-op as a platformer, you know, that was kind of a, you know, maybe not a new, brand new idea, but, you know, it was the first for the 2D Marios. The only thing that I've always been salty about is that, and apparently the reason why they didn't have Peach and they did two Toads instead was that her animating her dressy shoes, dress flippy thing was like, I don't know.
So it's a dress.
No, but, like, the way that her, like, shoes hovered or something, I don't know. There was some excuse why they didn't include her, so still salty about it.
Well, then I want to talk about the third Wii Super Mario game. This is Super Mario Galaxy 2, and it, you know, is actually, initially developed as just, like, an expansion to Super Mario Galaxy.
Yep, Super Mario Galaxy more!
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in a lot of ways, if the Wii had had better online architecture, this probably would have been the first big Nintendo DLC that we got.
Right.
You know, ultimately we end up getting, like, Pikmin as the first big one with DLC, at least on the consoles. But, you know, it's long been said Nintendo does DLC right. A lot of people loved the Super Mario Kart DLC. People are loving the Smash Brothers DLC.
Oh, yeah.
But really, if you think about it in that respect, Mario Galaxy 2 would have been, like, that level of DLC. It's basically uses the same gameplay elements as the original Mario Galaxy, gives you a couple of new powers, but most importantly, you know, adds Yoshi to the mix, to the 3D mix, which was a new thing for them.
Yeah. Oh, my God, that's so fun.
He kept all of the standard Yoshi 2D abilities, but just has them in 3D. Again, you know, the world design is done by worlds, they're themed, the theming is hella strong, the graphics are even better than they were in the first Galaxy, the art aesthetic is nuts. This is one of those games, like, that people back in the console wars days would be like, man, Wii graphics are so bad, it looks like you're playing a PS1 game, lol. And Nintendo fans would be like, oh, really? Because I would say Super Mario Galaxy 2 looks as good as your God of War bullshit.
Oh,
and it was
right.
Hard to look
better
at it.
Better than
not...
PS2 God of War.
PS2 God of War, yes. PS3 God of War, to be fair, really does look like a painting in motion.
That's true.
But
this ain't God of War, Bowie.
Well, yeah, but the point being that this game, the art aesthetic is so strong that it would it could hang with games on significantly more power. So it's just, to me, it's a really fantastic experience. One I'm super fond of.
If this one had an HD remaster, it'd be like, what?
So what do you have anything to say about Galaxy 2?
Just the one thing that I want to say is that I really think of this in the way I think of Super Mario 3, Sonic the Hedgehog 3, and Sonic and Knuckles. And not that it was like a split development thing, but just that really Mario Galaxy and Mario Galaxy 2 combined make pretty much like one of the most beautiful, one of the most technically astounding games ever created. And if you haven't played it, you know, you definitely need to find a way to play both of them.
The easiest way to play this one is that it is available on the Wii U as a Wii Virtual Console game in basically every territory. So definitely an easy way to jump in there. I'm going to move this conversation forward, go to the Nintendo 3DS, which on November 3rd, 2011 in Japan, November 13th, North America, and November 18th in the EU territories, got Super Mario 3D Land.
Yes.
This is such a fantastic game. It basically took sort of the 3D style of Mario games and put it into a gameplay setting of like the 2D Mario games, which Shigeru Miyamoto-san, who was the designer on this one, he very specifically stated that was their goal, was to make a 3D Mario game in terms of play control using level design reminiscent of the 2D series.
Right, so kind of like go from the start to the end.
This, of course, has been a huge commercial success. Despite being a 3DS game that's available only on the single platform, it has broken the 10 million sold mark, so, you know, definitely something good there. This is one of those things where I guess when I speak to people, I just assume they've played this game because it was such a phenomenal landmark experience. Despite being on the 3DS, the graphics are astounding. It actually uses the 3D capabilities of the console. For the screen to, like, use depth to actually help you judge, like, jumps and stuff. The game actually is
right.
One of the few games that is enhanced by playing in 3D, and there are very few of those.
That's true.
Again, you know, and something interesting is that this game was in a big way actually designed by Miyamoto-san to bridge the 2D and 3D games, like I said, because Nintendo had noticed that, you know, like, New Mario Brothers 2, New Mario Brothers for Wii had sold, you know, at the time, something like 20 million units. And then Mario Galaxy 2 sold like 4 million units.
Uh-huh.
And they were trying to figure out, like, why that is. And so they felt like if they connected the 3D Mario games to the 2D Mario games using this game, that it might help people get into the 3D space Mario games a little bit better. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding. I would say that that actually did come to pass.
Yeah, definitely.
Slaggy, why don't you talk a little bit about this?
I mean, that was really the talking point that I wanted to touch on. That just that, you know, we think of 2D Mario, 3D Mario, and this really was the merging point in that, you know, and we still continued to see new titles, and I presume we'll see, you know, a proper quote-unquote follow-up to Galaxy, but just that, you know, this really did blend the two, and just so, so great. And it, you know, was responsible for one of my favorite and most recent Mario games that we'll get to very soon.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, then let's move this conversation forward to
the next.
We're
going to coin rush it through to new Super Mario Bros. 2.
To the next 3DS iteration of the Mario series. This was New Super Mario Bros. 2, released on the Nintendo 3DS in Japan on July 28th, 2012. The EU territories, August 17th, 2012. Australia, August 18th, 2012. North America, August 19th, 2012. Italy, August 24th, 2012. Korea, December 26th, 2012. And last but certainly not least, Hong Kong, June 21st, 2013. This game, to date, has sold 9.30 million copies worldwide. Obviously, that's a pretty nice number.
Yeah.
And it's, again, you know, this game, and it's funny because this is another one that, like Sunshine, I think is disliked for wrong reasons. A lot of people trash this game. A lot of people spoke really badly of it. I think the only real reason for that is that New Super Mario Bros. U was due out just a scant, like, 3 months later. And I think that made it really hard for people to get excited for the 3DS version when it was like, no, the new Wii U is coming out and it's going to have a better version of this game. And I think it really set a very unfair tone for New Super Mario Bros. 2. New Super Mario Bros. 2 had, first off, a ton of DLC. What I'm going to talk about here. I wasn't super impressed by most of it, but there were a couple of cool stages. What's really interesting, though, is that the game was focused on collecting coins. It was practically a freaking Wario game. It was so focused on collecting coins. It was just super, like, coins everywhere. Like, to a degree, I literally can't even express it. Like, there were some levels that were literally just run in a straight line, collecting several hundred coins, and then you're done. It was nuts. It was silly. They had, like, a whole ad campaign about, like, how long will it take gamers to collectively reach 1 billion coins? Which played out over the internet. But overall, it was actually critically well-received, even if it was sort of the outlier on the low end in terms of Mario games. On Metacritic, it has a 78%, which is still, like, critically acclaimed, just not quite
right
on the tier of other Mario games and other new Super Mario Brothers games. But, you know, again, the people would criticize the game mechanics and just basically, I think, you know, sort of new Super Mario Brothers fatigue. But even the staunchest of critics were praising the game's level design. There were some really cool ideas here. Lots of that Super Mario Brothers 3 style exploration, some cool hidden stuff, you know, playing with how you defeat the enemies and use them as, you know, to get your higher bounce on in order to get to hidden ledges and what have you. Just a lot of really cool inventive stuff. I think this game is underappreciated, and I still think it's worth checking out. Saggy?
I agree. You know, I think especially if you're someone who is into, like, the collectathon sort of thing, that, you know, this is definitely for you. It makes me think of, you know, if you're someone who went through Mario Brothers 3 and you're like, all right, I'm going to go through and get all 44 coins in this level to get the White Toad House. Like, I think I can see where it maybe wouldn't appeal to every player, but then again, it sold almost 10 million copies, so I thought it was good. You know, it definitely, I think it stands out with its coin rush and the coin, you know. Coin,
you're coining way too much.
But yeah, and like the gold power and everything, like it's a fun game. Maybe not essential, but, you know, I think it's worth your while.
Agreed. Now we come to my favorite of the new Super Mario Brothers games. This is New Super Mario Brothers U. It released again just a scant few months after New Super Mario Bros. 2, released in North America November 18th, 2012, the PAL regions November 30th, 2012, and last but never, ever, ever least, December 8th, 2012.
Oh, that's right. They got the launch later than us, didn't they?
They did. You know, this one also had a very lengthy downloadable content released on June 20th, 2013, which was called New Super Luigi U. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But, you know, I had described previously how I felt like the New Super Mario Bros. Wii and New Super Mario Bros. 2 were flirting with a lot of design concepts from Mario 3. To me, New Super Mario Bros. U is the Super Mario World of the New Super Mario Bros. Games.
Yeah.
It really enhanced, like, giving the players more options, more abilities, a huge more focus on, like, multiple exits and exploration, some, like, incredibly, like, nails-hard hidden levels that are just phenomenally designed. I honestly think New Super Mario Bros. U has the best 2D level design of all the Mario games. Like, I truly believe that, and that is a tall damn statement. To me, this is an absolute must-play. I look at the fact that it has to date only sold 4.84 million units. And I actually get kind of bummed about that, because to me, of the New Super Mario Bros. Series, this should be the one that has sold 30 million units. This is the one that is, to me, incredible.
Yeah, but I mean, think about just the Wii U in general. So.
That is the obvious answer, Slaggy, but that doesn't mean I have to like it. I think the graphics are beautiful. The sound, you know, it does have some of the samey, sort of almost sterile at this point, sound work from the other iterations of the new Mario Brothers series. But overall, I think it's a great experience and an absolute must play. I think it's fantastic. Slaggy?
Yeah. No, I mean, you said it perfectly. Just again, Wano Peach, although I got my wish very, very, very soon after that.
Is that all you have to say?
Yeah, just, I mean, because, you know, we've talked about it here on air. This is definitely entering the era of Game Buoy. And just that, you know, really, like you've said, it's taken what started way back with New Super Mario Brothers in 2006, and, you know, at that point it was 6 years later, really just refining, and I think really, you know, showing some of the spectacular things that can be done with 2D platforming.
So we then got the new Luigi U DLC. I'm treating it as a separate game because it is actually got a commercial release as a standalone game. So to me, that makes it worth mentioning. Released in Japan, June 19th, 2013, released in the rest of the world on June 20th, 2013. That was the DLC version. It released all around the world in the following months at retail on a standalone disc. Basically, it took literally every stage of New Super Mario Bros. U, all of them, and gave every level a new level. So it's a complete overhaul, completely new stages, all designed specifically around Luigi's different jumping abilities and different play style. So all of the stages are shorter, but also require a great deal more skill to get
through. Yeah.
Once again, sort of looking at that sort of Super Mario Bros. 2 / Lost Levels.
Exactly.
Super Mario for pro players kind of setup.
That was exactly how I was going to say it.
It is tough as nails. It is super hard. And each level has a time limit that is way harsher than in any other Mario Brothers game that has ever existed, specifically to be like, go, 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 and apply that pressure on you. It is a astoundingly well-designed game on its own. And now, you know, it's most often sold now in a two-pack with New Super Mario Brothers for like $40 or $50. And to me, that is an incredible deal. You're getting effectively like 200 stages of just incredible ideas, incredible level design, good graphics. It's to me, it's a home run. It's a slam dunk all in one. I can't really speak too highly of New Super Luigi U. I think it's a great game. Truly a great game. Saiki, do you have anything to say about New Super Luigi U?
No, just that comparison to Super Mario Bros. 2 or Lost Levels is perfect. It's tough. But, I mean, I definitely appreciate it for what it is. And I'd love to see, you know, more Luigi. I liked the year of Luigi, and I thought that was a great way to honor him.
Well, then let's wrap up this conversation by talking about the most recent Super Mario mainline game. This is Super Mario 3D World.
Meow, meow.
Or, as we call it in studio, Super Mario Cats. This was released for the Wii U on November 21st, 2013 in Japan, North America, November 22nd, 2013, EU territories, November 29th, and Australia, November 30th, 2013. So everything within like a 10-day span. Nintendo's really gotten quite good at this.
Yes.
This takes the game design of Super Mario 3D Land for 3DS and kicks it up a notch in a big way. It adds four-player new Super Mario Brothers style co-op play. It gives you the new Mario power-up, which is the cat suit, which gives you a forward physical attack. It gives you a dive kick attack. It gives you like a hovery jump. It is just fantastic. Playable characters Mario, Luigi, Princess Peach, and Toad, all with their like different mechanical differences from Doki Doki Panic, Mario USA. Has Rosalina as an unlockable fifth playable character. She has her own abilities as well. It really just takes all of the ideas of new Super Mario Brothers, of Super Mario Brothers 3D Land, some stuff from Galaxy in terms of how theming is done and individual level challenges are done. It just takes all of these things, throws them into a blender, and to me comes out as like the perfect distillation of what the last 30 years of Mario Brothers games are all about. There's, you know, hidden stuff in every level. There's tons of exploration in every level. It's just, there is so much going on in this game. You have all the Captain Toad mini games in the game, which obviously spun out its whole entire like separate game. You had Bowser with a cat hat called Meowser, which, hello, that's adorable as shit. It is just a fantastic game experience. Incredible music. The graphics and art design are fucking nuts. This, to me, even still today, is one of the best looking games I have ever played. It would be impossible for me to say too many good things about this game. This, to me, is the absolute Wii U must-play game, even over something like Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
What do you have to say, Slaggy?
Just that, you know, you've really touched on a lot of these points already. It really is, like, I don't want to say culminating, because that would imply an ending, but, you know, it's really taken DNA from all of the Mario games. You know, you've got a little Mario 2, like you said, a little Galaxy, a little from 3D Land. You know, some of the platforming can be really challenging still, so it's not just like easy mode. And it's just it's one of my favorite Mario games. I mean, it's just like, just because it has all the things I like from different Mario games, you know. And the fact that I almost have no words for it speaks more than if I would be speaking for forever and ever about it.
All right, well then I think it's time to wrap up our conversation on the mainline Mario games. Obviously we will be back at you shortly with a discussion on the spin-off games, and we're probably also going to do an episode talking about sort of the non-game Mario experiences. So please look forward to our feelings on the Super Mario Brothers movie with Bob Haskins.
Yes.
But
I got a Mario month planned for you.
Until then though, Slaggy, what else, what how would you summarize your thoughts on the Mario mainline games?
Near perfection, must play, essential, joyful, adorable, smiles.
So basically,
life-changing
happiness. Got it.
I mean, it's gaming. That's I will always love Mario, because I mean, that's how I got my start in gaming. I think a lot of us really feel this way, and that just continues to really show why Mario is a worldwide phenomenon. Like at one point they say that Mario was more recognized than Mickey Mouse.
Yes.
I mean, it's just
yes
I'm just saying that, you know, there's a reason why. I mean, it's just really, I mean, how can you top it?
I don't know, but knowing Nintendo, I believe they will find a way.
And you know, just with Super Mario Maker, really just bring it, like we've talked about this as we've talked about leading up to the release, you know, just the fact that it's taking the tools and putting this in the hands of players is just, I think, really just a beautiful way to, you know, celebrate 30 years of this iconic, classic, groundbreaking franchise.
Absolutely. Well done. You know, to me, Mario in so many ways codifies what gaming is, how game design works fundamentally, and I am, as ever and always, beyond excited to see where Nintendo goes next with him.
Here's the 30 more years, and even then.
Hell yeah, here is to another 30 plus years of Mario.
And you'll be hearing it here on Game Buoy.
All right, well, with all that having been said, let's talk about a couple smashes real quick. The first one we've got for you is a fantastic piece over on IO9, which is a science fiction website I'm a big fan of. I love sci-fi. And they did an article called Metal Gear Solid is one of the most fascinating science fiction stories in any medium, that basically just goes over the history of Metal Gear Solid
Yeah,
and
great
why
reading.
It's a story that could only be told in the medium of video games, which to me, I think there is a tremendous value in stories like this. I am always interested in reading stories like this, and I think it's a fantastic article. I think it's one that's really worth reading, especially if you're looking at writing pieces about games like this that again can only be done as games, looking at these big stories, looking at how it all works. Just a great piece. I highly recommend you read. The second is a piece that ran on Kotaku yesterday. This is How Halo and Destiny's Composer Got Fired from Bungie.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, it sounds like clickbait garbage, but it actually is finally breaking down the details of the Marty O'Donnell and Bungie sort of kerfuffle. You know, they actually had a suit between the two of them. Marty O'Donnell sued Bungie for wrongful termination and other things.
I don't think we even had so controversial yet, but that was so controversial.
And, you know, there was a court ruling finally issued last week, and because of that, we finally know what happened. And, Kotaku actually did a bang-up job breaking down the legal issues so that anyone can understand it. So, well done, Kotaku. Good piece. And it's worth reading, especially if you're going to write about law issues in games.
Indeed.
All right, let's start up the wrap-up with talking about What's Up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
This week, I've played through Until Dawn. It was a fantastic experience. I played it with Xander, and who, you know, is a dead pirate king or something or another, I don't know. But either way, we played it sort of cooperatively in terms of, like, working together to, like, solve puzzles or whatever and decide what direction we're going to take the story in.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic experience.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but great things.
Yeah, it is less a game than, like, a Resident Evil or Silent Hill, and more of, like, similar to Until Dawn, Heavy Rain. It's right. More interactive movie than
kind of like
video
a choose-your-own-adventure.
But it's a great experience.
As a final girl.
Great experience. Super good story. Very happy with it. And to me, an absolute must-play if you're into horror movies or interactive movies that happen to be horrific. Slaggy, what about you?
This week's kind of been busy for me, but I've been smashing it up, trying to sharpen up my Roy a little bit more, trying to sharpen up my Peach, spending a lot of time just on random characters, trying to, get a feel for, different characters and see, maybe if there's other characters that I might have I might connect well with, so.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, if you don't have anything else, why don't we get some of these social links in?
Yes, let's start with our social links, and I want to start out by saying that if you are ever listening to our backlog or such, you can always tweet us, email us at any time. We'll give you that information shortly, but, please don't feel that if you did not hear an episode contemporaneously that you may not respond. So I want to start with our question of the week. We said, this week we begin celebrating 30 years of Super Mario by looking at the main series. How have these iconic experiences impacted you? Our first set of tweets comes from Your Enzyme, saying, the first game I ever owned was Super Mario Land. While it may not be a main game, it got me into my fave hobby of 23 years, smiley face. I've loved every Mario game that's come out. Sunshine is my favorite, with Galaxy 2 as close second, then Super Mario World in third. And I'm sad to admit, the only Mario game I didn't care for is Super Mario 3D World. Feels weird to admit that. Everyone has their own taste, but we're glad you're on the Sunshine team, for sure.
Dandy, yeah, that clearly, as we've talked about here on show today, it doesn't align with our opinions, but that's okay. It's, we all have different tastes. We all like different things in our gaming experiences.
Uh-huh.
And I don't, it shouldn't be weird to say at all. Fly that flag. We got you back.
Yeah, 3D World definitely does have a lot of, disparate elements connected together, so maybe for some people not that, not their cup of tea. Dan Diaz says, I come from a family of Italian plumbers, so Mario is the hero I relate to. Oh my god, really? But seriously, SMB2. The potions! Birdo! #DokiDoki. Man, yeah, Dan,
anytime you ever say "Where my people at, Slaggy," the answer is Dan Diaz.
Yeah. I need to talk to Dan Diaz next time, Dan, that I see you. We're talking about Super Mario Brothers 2. And then Krylo said, "Is there still time to respond?" And Captain Spike said, "Yep." So Krylo said, "Yay! Check the mail buoy when you get a chance." And we did, and we have a very special message from Krylo, a.k.a. our buddy Francisco.
And before we play this for you, I just want to say, this is an audio clip that Francisco sent in to us. We love this stuff. So
yeah.
By all means, if you're out there and you're, wanting to interact with us and you have more to say than you can fit in one tweet, you don't want to email us, by all means, shoot us a audio clip. We'll listen to it, play it here on the air, and then respond to
it. Yeah, and don't feel that you need to have super fancy mics. I mean, for cripe's sake, we started out with, recording on an iPhone or something, isn't that right?
Yeah, we recorded on an iPhone in the early days. We recorded on a single headset mic that we sat in between the two of us for a while. I mean, we recently bought some decent mics, but holy cats.
Yeah,
it has
please
been
don't
an
let
adventure.
That stop you. We love hearing you tell your stories like NPR style. And with that, here's Francisco's message.
Arg! Hi, Captain Spike and First Mate Sidekick. And all the listeners of GameBuoy.org. That's GameBuoy.org. This is Francisco, aka Cheeto16, aka Krylo. Anyway, 140 characters is not enough to contain everything that I'm about to say, so I decided to be a unique rebel and do this voice response thing. Hopefully this will encourage other listeners to kind of do the same thing, because I think it'd be cool to hear people, with their responses and what they have to say. Yeah, so with regards to Super Mario, Mario is family, especially back in the NES days, because back then, my dad and my uncle were sharing a house, and where we lived, there wasn't any kids our age. So I spent a lot of time with my cousins and my brother playing through Mario 1, 2, and 3, and we would spend hours playing those games. And, trying to find each and, tiny little secret or whatever. And when we would find one, we'd be like, oh my gosh, did you find the secret? Did you know that you could do this here and that there and whatnot? And so, as a collaborative effort, we all completed those games. And then there's Super Mario World, which, a lot of people love this game. I love it too. Anyway, when I got this game, I was spending a summer with my grandparents who live by the beach. So right away I think about the beach, but also, spending time with my aunts and uncles who really want to play this game too. And, putting the game in for the first time and it showing up on the screen. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever. And then, we discovered Yoshi and that was the best thing ever to happen to Mario. Cause it was so cool that, you had this thing, this dinosaur that you could, ride on and help you get through the level. That was so cool. And, I remember the music for, the castle stages would always make me so nervous that I couldn't play the game because my stomach was in knots, and so I'd have to have, my aunt or my uncle, one of them would have to, play and, beat those levels for me because I couldn't back then. But yeah, it was, family time, and together we all beat it, and that's pretty awesome. That same summer, my uncle, who actually ended up passing away from cancer a couple years ago, he introduced my brother and I to Mario Kart. So when I play Mario Kart, I remember him and how awesome he was at Rainbow Road and how he taught my brother and I to play. I don't want to take up too much time because I could keep going on about every little memory I have of Mario because there's so many of them. It's been such a huge part of my life, and I hope that it continues to be because it means family. And with Super Mario Maker, I can't wait to be creating levels because I'm going to have all my cousins, my aunts, and my uncles all try and see if they could clear my stages.
Oh, man, that was really special. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. We obviously share a lot of your enthusiasm about Mario World. It's just really touching to hear, that these games have as much value to you guys out there as
right.
they do to us in studio. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. That was a very special treat.
And before we wrap up the wrap-up, I'm going to just hit a couple of other tweets that were not about the question of the week. We got a tweet from Inverse Phase saying, thanks for following. Are you guys big fans of Ocean? Yes, my favorite is Pacific. No, but in all seriousness, you know, I have to admit that a lot of the stuff that Ocean did was a little bit before my time. You know, I'm a couple years younger than Captain Spike, so, you know, I definitely remember them doing a lot of licensed stuff.
I very distinctly actually loved their Darkman game, which maybe wasn't that great, but I really enjoyed it. You know, there was they did a couple of Addams Family games, including, you know, NES and Super NES Addams Family game that I really liked, even though it was maybe awful in the modern day. It was almost like Metroidvania-y, which was cool. Lots of like going through like a giant mansion with hidden doors and passages and just a very complex map. So I was super into it. And so, I mean, I guess it would be fair to say I like Ocean, assuming that's the Ocean you mean.
In response to us calling this next couple of episodes the Ninty-90s, your Enzyme says, well, aren't you boys clever?
Well, thanks. I think you're pretty clever, too.
Emiru69 had said, an awesome episode of GameBuoy.org. I learned so much about the Virtual Boy. Yay! Gamer Fox included us in a Follow Friday podcast edition, saying that us, among some others from the Hunty Bunch, are like candy for your ears. Yum! Ooh, this is candy. We're having fun. And we got a retweet from Twitter user JMasterClaw. So first of all, thank you for that. And then tagging Nintendo and Nintendo America, saying, hey, Nintendo and Nintendo America, when are we getting Virtual Boy games on Nintendo 3DS? Right? We feel
you
there.
I like you.
Yeah, we feel you there, JMasterClaw. And also in response to our Virtual Boy episode over on Facebook, Daniel T. said, I've always lived in a bubble, but the Virtual Boy is one of the products that really makes that apparent to me. I had a Virtual Boy near launch with 3 or 4 games, and I never realized it was poorly received or even noticed the short lifespan until recent years. Selling my NES and Virtual Boy as a child still haunts me. I'm not sure if I had read that it was meant to be worn on the head or not, but I attempted to create my own head mount for it. I cut up some old sheets and tried to use them to strap the Virtual Boy to my face. It really was far too heavy for what I had rigged up, so I generally play laying down on my back with the system just resting on my face.
I still play that way all the time.
Amazing. Great discussion, and I look forward to the remaining Nin episodes in this deck test. Oh, Daniel.
I like you guys.
Oh, I think Daniel already knows how I feel about him. Quite fond, indeed.
Keep it rolling, girl.
So, you know, we just want to say thank you. We always love your feedback. Make sure that we don't exist in a bubble or a vacuum. So if you want to check us out, you can, well, I mean, presumably you are checking us out, but we're over on iTunes, so we appreciate your subscriptions, ratings, and reviews, even when iTunes is being persnickety. We like your Facebook likes, and we effing love Twitter.
Yeah, we love Twitter. You can tweet at me, I'm at @SpikePoint.
You can tweet at me, and I'm at @SlagKick. And our GameBuoy Twitter is at GameBuoy.org with the .org spelled out .org.
At GameBuoy.org with the .org spelled out .org.
You can email us at mailbuoy@GameBuoy.org.
Mailbuoy@GameBuoy.org.
And, of course, all of our social links. You can also check us out on Stitcher Radio, which is a great place to listen to podcasts. And, of course, you can get all of these social links along with every episode that we've ever recorded, including the aforementioned iPhone, headset, microphone, etc. ones, over on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And with that, Sidekick.
Yeah, see, because we've been recording so long, you've gotten stupid. We're at shoutouts, yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
Spike, so, why don't you tell us what the realness is?
As ever and always, my first shout out goes to VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit chat among friends, as well as Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. I'd be remiss not to mention Nintendo Fun Club, your place for platformers, positivity, and pop punk, as well as their sister show, Enos Lives, looking at your favorite PlayStation 1 games one game at a time. We also, of course, want to shout out Nintendo Love Fest, which does exactly what it says on the tin, as well as their sister show, X Nation, over at culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. I'd also point you in the direction of Slagkick's show, our sister show, so to speak, Reading is Fundamental, serving up a weekly dose of tea on RuPaul's Drag Race when it is in season, in which Slagkick hosts, I'm the Bitch, and We also have Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio and Delvin from VG Realness. I also, of course, want to point you in the general direction of the Starboard Power Coupling Podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail. And last but never, ever, ever least, Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Slaggy, do you know what time it is? I want you to take us to a game bar!
Game Bar is the gay video game Prairie Home Companion. Koopa Club is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo, and it's gay, and the moms gave them an award. Joystick Jockeys are so gay. They are two boys who like to play video games and love talking about them. On the Voice of Geeks Network, you can find Girls Gone Well. It's about the World of Warcraft and stuff from female perspective. I'm gonna stop doing that. No, I'm gonna finish.
I'm legit impressed, but please stop. You've already called it. Just go.
Alright, but I feel bad for not shouting out to our boys at La Palanca Podcast, the podcast por y para gay gamers Latino Americanos en Español. Definitely a big fan of both of those gentlemen over there. And if you are a fan of the anime, then I recommend you check out Anime Buoy, your port of call for anime news, tidbits, and discussions that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. That's featuring two quite handsome fellows, known as Captain Spike and First Mate Sidekick, and they're over at AnimeBuoy.org.
AnimeBuoy.org.
But in all seriousness, we have, after saying, this isn't Anime Buoy, now we can say, oh, that's Anime Buoy. Because we decided to talk about anime, kind of doing the same thing we do over here. Our first episode looked at the films of Satoshi Kon. And
our next one is going to look at our favorite Space Cowboy and yours. Please look forward to it. Slaggy, wrap it up.
See ya, Space Cowboy. Oh, wait, not yet. Except for and always, we like to recognize our wonderful theme music done by Zelda Reorchestrated, the project that aimed to reorchestrate Zelda music into beautiful symphonic sound. And we'll be forever pouring out a 40 in the Great Fairy Fountain for them as they closed their doors a while back.
With all of that having been said, thank you, our lovely and beautiful listeners. We would not do this show without all y'all out there. We truly love talking to and interacting with you. We will be back at you shortly with another look at more Mario. But until then, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
And Mama Luigi. That's Mama Luigi to you, Mario.
Mama? Mama Luigi?
Mics are hot.
Hot mics, hot mics. Get your hot mics here.
Nobody's gonna know who's opening a fucking can.
They're like, that can sounded like it was opened a little gayer.
Exciting. Actually, I'm going to remove that exciting because that's bad news. We're going to talk about this game because it's super important. It's fundamentally important. Anyone who has a problem with that can go suck a fucking dick. And I ain't trying to be, like, unkind to you. I don't give a fuck if it's not left of center. In this one case, do not give a single fucking fuck.
Ooh, Peach. The Mushroom Kingdom, the castle is open. Welcome, Lady Toads and Toads, to Mario is Fundamental.
Super Mario.